Arabic language Shabab news agency reported that 11 protesters were struck with live bullets on Monday, while 12 others suffered wounds after being hit with rubber-coated steel bullets. Another Palestinian protester was injured by shrapnel. Dozens of demonstrators suffered tear gas inhalation as well and were transferred to hospitals for treatment. Earlier in the day, the fishermen committees of the Union of Agricultural Work Committees announced in a statement that Israeli forces had targeted Palestinian boats west of Rafah City.
The Intercept is reporting that an executive from Shell Oil told participants at a meeting of the Climate Change Congress, COP24 in Poland, that Shell helped draft a portion of the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement dealing with emissions mitigation. He made the remarks at an event for corporate actors, including the fossil fuel industry, saying that the European Union's position is not that different from how Shell sees this. Earlier this week, activists protested outside an event hosted by Shell. And among those demonstrating were Rita Uwaka, an organizer from Niger, who said, "It's like hell on earth. I represent communities in the Niger Delta who are impacted by this big polluter. Having this big polluter come here as a saint is not only a slap on us as delegates of the COP, but it's also a slap on Mother Earth." Activists at the climate summit are not allowed to specifically name oil and gas companies in their protests under threat of having their accreditation taken away by the United Nations.
And hello. If you've just joined us, please stay tuned for our regularly scheduled program of Indigenous Talk Radio with the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Find us on the web, ang-newswire.blogspot.com.
Suggested for mature audiences.
Recently, Alice Walker declined to have her book, The Color Purple, translated into Hebrew. She said that this was her way of protesting how she felt the Israelis were treating the Palestinians. And I'm really baffled. I'm really baffled by this, because she's in essence censored her own work. And she's now put on a different hat. She's put on an activism hat. She's put on a political hat. She's done what most people in her position protest that governments do, and that's blocked access from a certain population to her book. And it's actually from a particular country to her book. A lot of people are baffled by this. A lot of newspapers in Israel are saying, well, you know, if she has a point to make and she's making it in her book, why would she not allow us to read it? Why would she not want people to actually perhaps side with her position or to bring it into the debate and bring it into the discussion of what's going on? It actually is really baffling. And when we look at it and we say, well, this is what authors say they hope to do, is they hope to impact the reader. They hope to challenge the thought process of someone who's picking up their book. Or they hope to validate people who are sharing their views and want to feel the support of the author behind them. She's denied all of that to anyone who speaks Hebrew. And again, it's very baffling because it goes far beyond what the message of her book was. The message of her book, The Color Purple, was, among other things, a message of a hope for equality, whether it was equality between the races, whether it was gender equality that is huge in the book. I can understand her statement of saying that, you know, she does have political views and she might want to express them, but to express them by blocking, by putting barriers up between the reader and your book, That's hardly what an author would do. And so I really am just left baffled. And I'd sit there and I would conclude that all through my reading of Alice Walker's materials, I've really been very struck by her talent as a writer. But I have to say at this point that I have to separate the talent from the person who's generating that talent and really question the mind behind it. And if she does want to enter the political arena as an activist and she does want to make political statements, I think they need to be better thought out than this one. And I think she really needs to be looking at it much more globally and much more broadly than she's looking at it, because this one really undermines her own objectives and the objectives of art in general.
Angry Indian Radio. You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Stand up and fight for Indigenous rights.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
This is Indian land! Indian land! Indian land! Indian land!
You guys have no jurisdiction here.
Listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Real talk for the fourth world.
Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Who are you? You don't know. Don't tell me Negro, that's nothing. What were you before the white man named you a Negro? And where were you? And what did you have? What was yours? And how did he take it? What gun did you see? Where is your history? How did the man wipe out your history? How did the man, what did the man do to make you as dumb as you are right now?
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
All Indians, all over the land, all saying the same thing. This is our homeland. This is our birthright. They don't want any white man comes in here and tell us that you have to divide this up this way or that way. The white man doesn't own this land. Just because he has a gun, he said, I took your land.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Transmitting from within the occupied Aboriginal territories of North America to the people of the Fourth World and all ships at sea. This is Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Internet radio for the smart of the region.
Este es Aborigen Inteligente de Radio.
This is Radio Inteligente de Indigena.
Did I see you say that turquoise is the color? What's turquoise going to do?
Well, there is an energy that comes from a being called the Godhead, which is, I mean, we talk about God. The Godhead is not a guy with a beard sitting on a cloud. It is a massive spirit, the basis of all creation. And coming out from this Godhead, round all creation, through all the stars, through all the planets and everything else, is the life force known as the light. I mean, the Bible refers to the light. And within this light are various other energies which have certain gifts. And these other energies have a frequency that is the same as all the colors. And turquoise actually is the same frequency as an energy called love and wisdom. Therefore, when you wear that color, you attract it. When you wear black, you attract a color that is the opposite to love and all the things we wish to bring to the earth. And it attracts another kind of energy, which is very.
But this is very hard. This is very hard on priests and nuns, isn't it?
Well, maybe that's a sign that maybe all the truth is not in the hands of the traditional church that has been with us over all these thousands of years.
Well, now, let me get this story right. The press claim that you claim to be the Son of God.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true?
Yes, you see, the thing is that it's quite funny, really. You know, 2,000 years ago, had a guy called Jesus sat here and said these same things, you would still be laughing. It's really, really funny that we've not really moved on that much. When we think, it is not a vacuum. When we think, we create an energy field. This is how telepathy works. An energy field leaves one being and other beings can tune into it and read that thought. When you think thoughts of love and wisdom and of tolerance and all the things we wish to bring to the earth, you create a certain kind of thought energy, the very same energy that the Godhead sends around creation. When you think the other thoughts of hatred, of anger, of aggression, you create a different kind of energy known as negativity, which is very, very destructive. This being called Lucifer lives off this energy. So the more that is produced on this planet, the more powerful that being becomes. Therefore, he stimulates and has stimulated this planet over 12,000 years since he's been in control to produce as much of this energy as possible.
So evil has been in control of the planet for 12,000 years?
It has been the dominating force. Evil's not the right word. It is imbalance. But it has been increasingly in control. As I repeat, survey the world, ladies and gentlemen. Is the force of love in control of this world, guiding this planet at this time? Of course not. The negativity, the thoughts that I'm talking about that are very destructive, are pouring out of this planet every day.
Was it a great shock for you to discover this at 38?
Well, I think the word is gobsmacked. But again, you know the best way of removing negativity is to laugh and be joyous. So I'm delighted that there's so much laughter in the audience tonight.
But no, it's in.
But just let me say this.
They're laughing at you. They're not laughing with you.
Fine.
Internet radio for smart of the radio.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Transmitting to the people of the fourth world from within occupied North America, this is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Welcome along, Salaton and peace to all original human beings resident on the physical plane. I'm your host, Angry Indian, editor-in-chief of the Aboriginal Press News Service, blogging to the people of the fourth world from aboriginalnewswire.tumblr.com and aboriginalpress.wordpress.com, as well as our main news portal, ang-newswire.blogspot.com. And along with my co-executive producer and master studio engineer, Ms. Guadalupe Morales, we welcome you back to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio, the official broadcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service, coming straight at you from Everyman Studios in unceded Chinookan People's Territories, North America, otherwise known as Portlandia, or PDX, depending on what your mood is. But that's not what I'm here to talk about today. What I'm here to talk about today is Alice Walker. And not so much about Alice Walker, but only in the fact that Alice Walker, the scandal, if you want to call it that, right now, about Alice Walker, is so connected to every fucking thing I've been talking about over the past several years, it's not motherfucking funny. We're caught up in a whirlwind of fucking stupid here. And, you know, just because Alice Walker is black does not mean that I'm supposed to fucking back her. You know, Farrakhan's black too. And I tried my goddamn best. I pretended to not hear what the fuck I heard. I pretended, you know, I rationalized this. You know, just like we always do, right? You know, I mean, because black folks, we do this. Don't we? And yeah, full disclosure, I'm part Jewish too. So, you know, if you're expecting me to be 100%, you know, okay with this, I'm not. This is something I've had to live with my entire motherfucking life. Now, you know, I really haven't made too much of a deal about running around, except for the past couple of years, because I feel like I've had to. You know, the white guy in my family was Jewish, and that's the thing. You know, he was just the white guy in my family. You know, I never really, you know, nobody practiced the belief. Nobody really did anything. I mean, you know, you might light a menorah every now and again for, you know, for nostalgia's sake, but that's about it. But, you know, here it is. We're in the silly season. We're in the holiday season. And this has to come out after Farrakhan calls Jews termites, which is then followed by a racist attack on a synagogue somewhere in New York City. And we look at the security footage, and it turns out that it's a black youth right? And then we have was it Prince William County, whatever it is over there, D.C., Maryland, whatever it is, black community. They got a young councilman over there, or a member of the city board, something like that. I can't remember. I'd have to look for it. Luke, if you want to look for it and put it on my screen, go right ahead. I don't remember his name, and I'm not here to demean him or to denounce him, but I will demean and denounce what the fuck he was saying. He was, you know, talking the same, well, you know, Jews control the world, and it's a conspiracy theory between the Jews and the Illuminati and the communists and what have you. Who's pumping that type of shit? Where did that start? You know how many black men I've had to argue and have had physical fucking encounters with, you know, who want to fight me, another motherfucking man of color, because they believe that the protocols of the elders of Zion is a real goddamn document. That Jews are really trying to take over the world. And that Jews are using black people to take over the world. And when I tried to explain to this fucking guy, first off, that shit was created by the Tsarist goddamn Russian police, he said he didn't care. The truth doesn't matter where it comes from. I said, oh, even when it comes from white supremacists, the truth doesn't matter, right? Because you know, they tell truth, right? And see, and that's the thing with these black supremacists out here. The new batch of black supremacy. I don't remember this when I was young. But, you know, since the late 80s, there's been this creep. And the Nation of Islam is primarily responsible for this. And yeah, I'm putting this on the NOI because they're primarily responsible for this. Not for creating Judeophobic literature and nonsense. No. Don't take me out of context. Because that's where a lot of Zionists are going with Alice Walker. They're not using her as a blunt instrument in terms of, well, you know, she's the leader. Her and Farrakhan somehow are leading a black anti-Jewish cabal. Well, Farrakhan perhaps. Alice Walker is just a fellow fucking traveler because, like a lot of goddamn people, like a lot of fucking people, like too many goddamn people in the fucking black community, they do exactly what everybody else does. You know, see, this is the thing when people want to tell me that they're the number one human, but somehow the things that make us the most human, that they reject. So, you know, it's just like when I have disagreements with Native American people, and I'm not talking about Elizabeth Warren right now. I mean, that's a major right now. But, you know, there are indigenous folks that don't want to hear any stories, any information, you know, any factual goddamn evidence that Native Americans, First Nations people, whatever, in North America, have ever succumbed or have ever gone into cannibalism. Well, that's complete bullshit. All human beings have dealt with cannibalism to some fucking degree or another. When starvation comes around, cannibalism fucking takes place. You know, when we talk about Wapanui, otherwise known as Easter Island, now, you know, there's been a number of indigenous extremists, and they're out there. Now, they're not doing violence except to each other, okay, and to other indigenous people. You know, because it's the same problem in Native country. You got a lot of motherfuckers that talk about, you know, they're proud to be Lakota, they're proud to be, Cherokee, they're proud to be whatever the fuck it is. Now, the Cherokee don't have a reservation. But when you have these isolated Native communities, you got plenty of people to talk about Indian first, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, while they're selling dope, while they're selling women, while they're selling protection. What they do with the Oglala, the guardians of the Oglala Nation, otherwise known as the goddamn goon squad who went around murdering Native Indian, No, Luke, because I'm fucking frustrated. American Indian people were murdered, killed, murdered, framed by other Indian fucking people who were working with the FBI. Now, you know, folks are going to decide to say to me, well, you know, what the fuck does this have to do with Alice Walker and Jews? It has a lot to do with it because a lot of Native people refuse to this day, and the older they are, the worse it is. They refuse to condemn Native American gangsters. I mean, we got gangsters. Well, we always did. But I mean, we really have gangsters now. We really have gangsters now. I'm not talking about gangs. I'm talking about we have organized crime in Native communities. That rivals anything going on in the black community. That rivals anything going on in the Armenian community. That rivals anything going on in the Irish community. That rivals anything going on in the Spanish-speaking world. We have our crooks too. we're fucking human beings. So just like the black community would say, well, you know, these guys right here, these young men are right here selling dope. And I'm saying men, but we know full well it's co-ed, right? That, you know, they're selling dope because of conditions out there. You can't be mad at them. You know, they're shooting people. They're causing all kinds of fucking shit, but you can't be mad at them. You know, they're ruining families. They're selling dope by schools, but you can't be mad at them. They're pimping underage girls, which you can't be angry with. Because they're black men and they're going through a struggle. Right, so right now we're dealing with that with Alice Walker. Well, you can't be against Alice Walker because she's Alice Walker. And if she said this, then there must be a reason. And I've spoken to, because this just came out yesterday, and I've spoken to four black folks, right? Well, actually five. Five. And, yeah, five. And none of them want to hear this. They're all telling me I'm wrong, that we need to wait and see what this is about. Well, we need to wait and see what this is about, but she's been doing this for a while. And what is really getting me is she is backing, all of this came out really yesterday, because she's backing a new book, which I know nothing about, by David Icke. Now, some of you know who David Icke is. David Icke is this nutcase that after the V series came on television in the early 80s, did you remember that? Are you old enough, some of you, to remember that? Because apparently you don't. Because when I mentioned the V television series to a couple of fools, they didn't know what I was talking about. His whole reptilian, that these are really reptile people that are in disguise, that are Jews, that are controlling the world, you know. What the fuck is wrong with you? What the fuck is wrong with people? You know, first off, you're pro-black, and, you know, white people don't have anything to say, you know, that they're always fucking stupid, this, that, and the other, unless they're Alex Jones. Unless there's somebody like David Icke, that pushes some wild-ass craziness that you can't just, it's like, what is it? David Icke, and see, that's the other thing, you know, because I get on this with, and I'm just talking right now, you know, black folks who would defend Alex Jones to me, and defend David Icke to me. And, you know, a few months ago, I had a black guy who was defending David Duke until somebody pointed out that he was a fucking Klansman. He didn't know, but he was ready to fight me because I told him that his support for David Duke was motherfucking ridiculous. He took his fucking coat off. You understand what I'm saying? You know, he wanted to fucking get down, right? Over this, over a motherfucker. Then when it's shown to him that this guy is a white, you know, a fucking white supremacist, he goes, then why are so many brothers listening to him? Then there must be some truth in what he's saying. You know, this rationalization, this, yeah, it'll work. If I think positive, it'll work. If I continue to put out more bullshit, it'll work. If I shout louder than the fucking other person that's giving me a fact, I'm telling the truth because I can outshout them. And if I can take my coat off and kiss your ass or intimidate you, then that means I'm fucking right. No, he was completely goddamn wrong. Was he a Farrakhan supporter? Yep. He also watches Fox News on a goddamn regular basis. You know, and again, it's not just, you know, these idiots. Alice Walker is just a piece of this. You know, now, while I'm not accusing them of first off, let's just get that straight, too. You know, the term anti-Semitism is really a whole lot of bullshit. The way it's been used, the way it's been countermanded. Same thing with genocide and Holocaust. You know, that if you want to get on the Zionist lobby, not Jews, but if you want to get on the Zionist lobby who did this, the group of atheists that started that bullshit, right? If you want to get on them, and I point that out because, you know, they used the Bible, or used the Torah anyway, the first book of the goddamn Bible, or the Old Testament, if you want to be one of these Christian literalists, you want to be Mike Pence about it all. They have no religious beliefs. You know, you have to understand it. You know, the majority of them, Ben Gurion, Herzl, all of them were atheists. They were not practicing Jews. Because, see, that's the thing about being Jewish that's fucking funny. You're not really a race. And you're not really a belief. It's like your religion. That's treated as a race that really isn't a race. And then at the same time, even if you don't practice the fucking religion, people still treat you shit. They try to kill you. They separate you over into communities and shit that are walled off from the rest of the goddamn world. So, you know, it's why? What is it? You know, yes, there's a lot of confusion. Yeah, I know you hear all kinds of shit in the black community. Well, you know, these are white Jews and they're fake Jews. Well, that's about as fucked up as you know, people, indigenous Africans, saying that, you know, Africans in the Americas and you know, North and South, well, we're not really African because, well, you're born over there and you're mixed. Because, you know, that's the same sort of litmus test that you're putting on Jewish people in Europe. They were ejected from Palestine in 70 AD by European power, otherwise known as the Roman goddamn empire. Right? Spread out everywhere. Spread out to China. Spread out to India. There's Jews all over the motherfucking bubble, man. Everywhere except for the Americas until, right, you know, immigration and so on, and that kind of thing made that possible, and people ended up leaving Europe because they couldn't fucking stay. You know, World War One was not just the Habsburg Empire coming down. You know, they were using that shit as an excuse to go after Serbs that weren't considered to be worthy of any goddamn thing. You know, how many Jews do you think got killed in World War One? How many Roma? How many Gypsies you think were being killed? And people are still making excuses for this shit. We're still making excuses for why, you know, Catholic Europe allowed Jews and Serbs and Roma and other ethnic minorities to burn. You know, the whole idea of the Reconquista of Palestine for Europe when, you know, the whole religion is based on Judaism, right? It's like, you know, the Catholic Church instituted that entire fucking thing. And then it bounced back to somehow, you know, now we got Jews all over the fucking place, but we don't want them. Yeah, but Jesus was a Jew. Yeah, but that's... We don't want these people. And even after... I mean, what? You go from being purely Semitic to going to China, to going to, let me just say Asia, greater Asia, right? Going to continental Europe, going wherever the fuck they went, wherever they could goddamn go, because really, just like anybody else, you're trapped by your circumstances. So they traveled through the fucking Roman Empire. They went to the outskirts, as far as they could go to the Roman Empire. Yeah, and then look at how crazy, right, Lou, we were just talking about this not too long ago, how Europeans had completely countermanded that. So now... not only is Christianity, which has nothing to do with fucking Europeans, really, but, you know, how it's gone from this, you know, Jewish belief system, but Jewish cult, really. That's what it is. It's a Jewish cult based on the teachings of one particular person who may or may not have goddamn existed. But in any motherfucking case, you know, not only do they claim that Christianity is their fucking religion, that they had to go all the way over to Palestine to take from Jews and Muslims, that somehow... the royal families of France, anyway, this Merovingian bullshit, that somehow, you know, Jesus came and gave the royal families of France. It's just ego. It's fucking ego. Now, I don't know what the fuck is going through Alice Walker's mind. I really don't. I mean, if I had it here, I'd ask those of you who are listening to the podcast, can reach out to you, tell her she's welcome to come on this broadcast and explain to me and everybody else why David Icke's book makes any motherfucking sense, because I'm saying this sight unseen, and if you want to criticize me for saying this sight unseen, go right the fuck ahead, because I know full well a lot of you are backing her on no motherfucking information. You don't even know what the fuck you're supporting. You don't know what, I know the majority of you don't know what the fuck you're supporting. You really believe that there's a race of reptilians that are controlling the United States through you know, by using black people and manipulating historical events? You really believe this? You really believe this? And people get upset with me because I'm saying that I'm sick and tired of motherfuckers, you know, in their goddamn late 30s and 40s demanding to be recognized as a fucking oppressed group because they play video games? Do you know how many black women, well, actually, I shouldn't say black women, because there's a whole lot of women that are friends of mine that are telling me shit like this, that they can't get their husbands to get the fuck off the goddamn Xbox. Yeah, I identify that as a motherfucking problem. And if you have a problem with that, that's your motherfucking problem. Grown men, look, you know, I swear, I don't know how many times I've said this. I'm a chess player. And, you know, I love the game. But I've never loved it so much where I identify it as one of the pieces on the goddamn board. You know, I don't live my life going through life, you know, imagining that I'm a rook. You understand what I'm saying? And that I can jump over pieces and make, you know, and do these odd moves. You know, I don't go into my office wearing a rook hat and all this kind of shit. I don't go home to Ms. Angry Indian and say to her that, you know, I don't like what's for dinner today or whatever the fuck because it's violating my feelings as a rook. Is anybody following me here? Are you following me with this? You know, these motherfuckers, man, I never even really paid attention to these goddamn games. You know, as I just said, the computer games I play are chess, but I've never paid attention to Grand Theft Auto or whatever the fuck. And Ms. Angry India, my wife pulled me aside one afternoon because she was at a friend's home. And it turns out that this woman's young son was playing this game and didn't realize herself how violent the fucking game was. Because I guess if you kill prostitutes or hurt women or run over people with your car, you get points or whatever. Yeah, and you get more weapons. I mean, I'm sorry. That this bullshit about the soldier and all of us and all this crap and you motherfuckers living vicariously through these goddamn video games. Y'all need to grow the fuck up. And if, like I said, if you're offended by what the fuck I just said, that's your goddamn problem. There's a big difference between having a fucking interest and taking this shit to these goddamn degrees. You're not living in the real fucking world. Alice Walker is out here backing a book by a son of a bitch who not only claims to be God. Yeah, I mean, is he still making that claim? And I'm not talking about Clarence 13X and 5%. I'm talking about, because that was supposed to be a theoretical thing. And of course, after Clarence 13X died, it became a literal fucking thing. Are you following what I'm saying? The more American, the more assimilated we've got. I'm talking about blacks and Jews. I'm talking about Native Americans. I'm talking about Latinos. The more we have assimilated. An unconscious simulation. And what I'm trying to say is there's nothing wrong with groups meeting and mingling. That is the nature of the fucking human experience. But there's a big goddamn deal with what the fuck is happening and what I'm talking about. Now, I know I've mentioned, and people have gotten offended about this too, right, Luke? Because I say it in my private life. You know, folks who, well, you know, what you're saying is antiquated, man. And, you know, I've never seen this, that, and the other. And it's just like, you know, what the fuck are you talking about? And then they start pulling this.
Well, you know, everyone has an opinion. And if you look online, you'll see.
And it's like, you know, whatever. And this, you know, yeah, I mean, that too.
Whatever.
You know, all this bullshit. You hear women, black women from the hood talking this bullshit. It's like, you know, well. Wow, where did that come from? You know, because a lot of this, and hey, I'm really in no position to say anything but my goddamn stuttering and my own speech patterns. But the point that I'm trying to make is because I've had these experiences is that, you know, when you take on speech patterns, you take on mannerisms and shit that really are not yours, you're trying to make changes. And, you know, there's nothing necessarily wrong with that. But what are you moving yourself into? You know, Malcolm, not Malcolm X, even though he has said this, and a lot of you like to quote him, but you don't live. Quote a lot, but you don't live shit. You don't live, you're not living Malcolm at all. You're just regurgitating and repeating what the fuck you heard, but you're not actually doing what the fuck he was talking about. Because one of the reasons why I'm on this right now is because a lot of people are using Malcolm X to defend Alice Walker. But Malcolm X, at least if we're going to go by the position on that the position that he was in, and the positions that he held when he died.
We can go back and forth in history and go back to 56 or 57 and pull whatever we want from Malcolm X. It has no real fucking relevance. He was not the same man that died. Right? Because I know there are motherfuckers out here talking about, oh, well, Malcolm X got weak. If he's so weak, then why did the Nation of Islam get rid of him? Why did the New York City Police Department allow the Nation of Islam to get rid of him? Why did COINTELPRO allow the Nation of Islam to do him? How stupid can you goddamn be? How stupid can you fucking be? I mean, we play all kinds of audio here. We just had Like It Is with Gil Noble, where he spoke to Othello, D'Artagnan Perry, who said his whole fucking job working for COINTELPRO, working for the FBI, was to set up black organizations, to frame black organizations. That was his assignment. That was his job. That's exactly what the fuck he did. When he got up every day, his goal was to damage black people from the fucking inside. And we just got a goddamn, you know, another motherfucking intelligence report that says what? That, you know, from this fucking country, that the Russians have been using black people as cannon fodder. Right? Political fucking cannon fodder. By pushing all kinds of anti-Jewish, anti, you know, and when I say anti-white, I'm not talking about anti-white racism. I'm not talking about anti-Klan. I'm not talking about anti-Nazi. I'm talking about anti-fucking just hate white people because they're white. You know, don't bring up the context of colonialism, racialism, none of that. You know, that's to say because they're white people, they're shitty. And, you know, they're no motherfucking good. They're of the devil. And da-da-da-da-da-da-da. But then you'll take that and then defend Farrakhan bringing Scientology, which was created by L. Ron Hubbard, a motherfucking white racist who died in South Africa, apartheid South Africa. Because, you know, the Nation of Islam has a research department, but somehow their research department didn't know this. That they're taking on the fucking belief system, a fabricated, I mean, really, this motherfucker wrote science fiction books. That's what he based his religion on. This whole thing about the operating feet is a goddamn sci-fi fucking story. And if you want to know, I'll tell you something slick. If you read Efforts for Fascism, which you can find at my website, well, at least my blog, aboriginalwriter.wordpress.com, I advise you to go over there and get yourself a copy. Or you can go on my Twitter feed, at The Angry Indian, and go to my main page and you will see it. It's right fucking there. I mentioned and showed all of my goddamn sources in Efforts for Fascism that the Nazi party, the Nazi ideas were based primarily, not just on hating Jews, but based primarily on a motherfucking science fiction book called Vril. V-R-I-L. Vril. The Coming Race. It's about a master race of blonde, blue-eyed Nordic Aryans who live underneath the fucking earth. To contain their power, because, you know, they're Vril, they're white essence. If it gets out there, it's just gonna destroy everything because there's no control to it. Supposedly these people come from the black sun. Not black in terms of black people. Because when I tried to explain this to some fucking young guys, you know, they just ran and jumped up and down talking about this food that they were superior. I'm like, no, man. The black sun has nothing to do with black skin. They're talking about the blackness of emptiness, of zero. That they come from the ether. That they come straight from God, prophets. This is what the Nation of Islam is doing right now. This is what Alice Walker is perpetuating right now. David Icke and Alex Jones, they're all a part of this white supremacist thing that you can be down with them if you're an operating white man, if you're an operating feet. Do you follow what I'm saying? Do you get what I'm saying? On how this shit is twisted out of proportion and then people take what they want from it and stretch it out even further. And you don't even realize where this shit is coming from. Alice Walker is out here pushing a white supremacist meme that's been going on for more than fucking what? Since the end? Probably since the fall of the goddamn Roman Empire, because, you know, they were actually, you know, to some degree blaming Jews for that too. I mean, really, Alice fucking Walker. And I know that, you know, there are black people right now where he's mad because he's just mad because he's Jewish. No, I'm angry because of the fucking stupidity. If you're backing Alice Walker, then what you're saying is, it's just like when Republicans are like, well, I support Trump. Well, that means you support the Klan and white power. And he's already admitted to being a goddamn nationalist. There's no fucking debate anymore. So, of course, to defend themselves, you know, the QAnon, the GOP, the MAGA fuckers, you know, the Tea Party, the tea baggers, they try to turn this shit around that you're really the hater. Right, what was that? Pastor Mark Burns talking about, well, you know, you hate white people, I don't hate anybody. The real racism is in the Democratic Party, because they started the Klan. Well, first off, the Democratic Party did not start the Klan. The Klan was started in the fucking South by former Confederate fucking soldiers. And of course, the majority of them are Democrats because they were in the South. It was their geographic fucking location, not their political fucking beliefs. That is an idiotic fucking thing to say. Because, you know, when the Republicans like to say, oh, well, you know, we were trying to help black people. But that's funny because, well, Lincoln sent blacks to Grenada. And they wanted to send all fucking black. This was a plan that President Lincoln had. They wanted to send all goddamn black people to fucking Africa. No matter where they came from, just dump them on the fucking shore. Get rid of them. You're, okay, the only reason why it didn't happen is because nobody wanted to pay for the fucking ships. Nobody wanted to pay for it. It's the only reason why it didn't go down. So, you know, the Anti-Colonization Society. Was that the name that they used? Help me here. The rich Northerners who were backing the Back to Africa movement at the time. Well, again, it was just to get rid of black people. It's because they really want, you know, people fucking want to be repatriated. A lot of fucking folks had been born over here by that time. They didn't know anything about Africa. Only what they heard. They didn't know anything. But the main deal was Liberia was founded on that, right? So you get a lot of motherfuckers here who jump up and down talking about Liberia. How much do they know about Liberia? Did they know that the ex-slaves who went to Liberia were then, you know, initially used, but after a generation or so, they picked it up. Well, after a few fucking years, they picked it up and they ran with it. They got themselves where they started treating the native population. Because you have to be funny about how you use indigenous, even in Africa. Because I know a lot of people over here, again, total misunderstanding on terms. Total misunderstanding and non-knowledge on politics. If you go to the African continent and say that you're an indigenous person, you'll be thrown out of buildings. You'll be thrown out of fucking offices. You'll be thrown out of fucking apartments. You can be thrown out of a fucking restaurant over there. They don't want indigenous people around. They consider themselves to be modern, post-colonial, and post-colonial Africa has no room for indigenous people. I mean, where you see Nigeria and Sudan and what have you, those are old colonial fucking lines. Did any of the post-colonial anti-white motherfuckers give up any of these lines? No. Did they empower the indigenous people within their claim borders? No. They're taking their land every goddamn fucking given opportunity. Same thing has happened in South America. I mean, I would like to support a lot of the natives that have become political leaders in South America, but they started chopping up Indian land too. They started, you know, taking shit from Indian people too. And in Chiapas, what the fuck is going on in Chiapas? Right goddamn next door. How many of the presidents have been of Indian descent? And how badly had they treated indigenous people there? Look at Duterte in the Philippines. Do you think that motherfucker is of Chinese descent? Is of Spanish descent? No, he's not of the landed gentry. I do not like Duterte. He's a fucking hypocrite. He's a fucking murderer. He has admitted to killing people. His fucking son and son-in-law are drug dealers, and they got away with it. Why he's 9,000 people now dead from Duterte's war on drugs? But look at him. He's indigenous. Look at him. He is indigenous. And what is he doing? He's killing indigenous fucking people. Now, when I wrote about Obama, when he was still in goddamn office, by the way, because you can still find that book out there too, African Judas, which is, you know, like most of my books, is a collection of my notes over a period of time. And it's like, hey, Septimus Severus. Now, you know, a lot of people have copped this and have not given me fucking credit for it, but, you know, the shit on the PDF, the goddamn book, is dated. Right. Motherfuckers wanted to talk about Obama after he left office. I talked about Obama while he was in office, and it wasn't because he was black. I was just saying the motherfucker's just going to do what, you know, every assimilationist
at that level is going to fucking do. He's talking a whole lot of shit about how he'll put on comfortable shoes and come out there. He didn't do anything. He didn't do anything about police brutality. He didn't defend the black farmers in the Midwest. While Trump is giving the white farmers that he fucked over with his goddamn trade policies, he's paying them with American tax money. The black farmers who got screwed over got nothing. They've got nothing. They lost every goddamn thing. All motherfucking on public assistance. They lost everything. They lost everything. So, you know, Obama was good for white people. You know, black wealth went down under Obama. Black unemployment and shit has, you know, it didn't really make much of a fucking change because it wasn't like a lot of motherfuckers got good jobs. You know, motherfuckers got entry-level jobs at 36. Okay? Entry-level jobs, working at McDonald's and shit, that's what Obama did. And if you're going to give him credit for anything, give him credit for what he actually did. You know, how many motherfucking black people to this day? Because I ask folks whenever I think about it, at least once a week, don't I? At least once a week, I ask folks, did Obama deserve the Nobel Peace Prize? And black folks would tell me, well, yeah, he deserved it because all the other white guys got one. That's not a reason to give somebody a peace prize. Is that your politics? Because if that's your politics, then that explains why so many black folks are defending Alice Walker, who does not deserve to be defended. Now, if, you know, again, the Zionist lobby is going to, the Hasbara lobby, I should say, they're going to use this politically to drive another wedge between black and Jewish people that really shouldn't fucking be. You know, so you got Farrakhan, and now you got goddamn Alice Walker doing this shit. I mean, I'm not really surprised by this. I'm not. And, you know, in a lot of cases, I really wish motherfuckers would read Eric Fromm. Because, you know, some of this, and I said this the last broadcast, some of this we're doing to ourselves. Some of this we're doing to ourselves. I mean, if you're Jewish and you think that you need to support Israel just because you're a Jew, and just because it's making the claim to be a Jewish state, despite the fact that, you know, it's a genocide process there. That colonialism is a genocidal process. You see? And that Palestinians were always goddamn there and have no right to be moved. Because, see, if you're going to tell me that Israel has the right to retake Palestine and, you know, by moving away the people who had nothing to do with their being removed from, but then you tell me you support native rights, you're a fucking hypocrite. You can't do both. You can't do both. You can't do both. And then, like I said, you know, black folks who have an ego fucking problem and don't want to accept the fact that they were tricked by what is called the Internet Research Agency. I know, when I first saw IRA, I thought they were talking about IRA. It's like, what does the IRA have to do with political polarization in the United States? They've never gotten that deep here. Well, actually, they have. I mean, if you look at Peter King, I think he's from New York State. He's a representative out there. I mean, he's been a member of the IRA for decades. And, you know, he had a beef with them over the Iraq War because they wouldn't endorse it. So he stops sending the money somewhere. If you ask him how he feels about Irish independence, he'll tell you that he's okay with the bus bombings. He's okay with the assassinations. He's okay with the, yeah, you know, all of it. Same thing with you, if you support Zionism. Which Zionism in and of itself is not a bad thing. But revisionist Zionism, that's something else. Those are the motherfuckers from Irgun who were doing the assassinations and shit. Like Folk Bernadotte or the other British and American dignitaries that they were trying to assassinate and shit so that they could take Palestine for themselves. They didn't give a fuck about a British mandate. They were going to take it for their fucking selves. And, you know, this is not a good example, but everybody should read it anyway just to know what the fuck I'm talking about. Leon Uris, they made a film of Exodus. It is one of the most racist, violent goddamn... if you read The Spook That Sat by the Door, it doesn't come across anywhere near as bad as Exodus does. And Exodus got a major Hollywood production treatment. Whereas, you know, Spook Who Sat by the Door had to receive independent fucking funds. But even with that, all the motherfucker can see is the guns and the riffing. You don't understand the politics. you're not really listening to the context of every fucking thing. The majority of you don't read any goddamn thing. You know, you read your pro-black pamphlets and shit. You know, read a fucking book for a goddamn change. Try doing Malcolm and read the motherfucking ditch. Do that. How about that? Put a real feather in your fucking cap and read the motherfucking ditch so you could actually understand the words and shit that you fucking use. Because so many of you do not. Who still take the term or the word ignorant as a personal insult without understanding that it means you do not know what the fuck it is that you're talking about. I can't get along because the politics of today are personal. It doesn't matter that I'm right or wrong. It's what I fucking think. It's what I believe. It doesn't matter that I'm right or wrong. What matters is what I think and what the fuck I believe, because I can force reality through my will, right? But you can't get any more fucking satanic. If you want to get into philosophies than that, read the satanic goddamn Bible. You know, Anton LaVey, for those of you who don't really understand where these ideas are coming from. Go further to Aleister Crowley. You alright? To see where this shit that you're calling the occult, where it's actually fucking coming from. You're perpetuating it and you don't even fucking realize it. And then you go on some crazy progressive Professor Griff bullshit that the Illuminati is trying to trick you through music videos. But the thing about it is, yeah, you got a white director and, you know, or a white producer and that sort of thing, making a lot of these things, but you're going along with it. You're writing the lyrics. I mean, I keep trying to tell people, I know producers, I've known people in this game, and they told me, yeah, man, nobody's twisting their motherfucking arm. Shit. Okay, these motherfuckers are out here trying to make money, they're trying to be large, and they only complain when the shit don't work. When it comes down, crashing down. Right, what's the name of that rapper? I don't even know what I don't remember what Travis is, but apparently he's got a... He's a South American and race rapper, whatever his name is. He's got tattoos all over his face, he's got dreads and all this kind of shit. There's a couple of them out there. And no, I'm not talking about Lil Wayne, but you know, they were probably copying him. I mean, there's a few of them out there. And anyway, he's got, you know, black people are pissed with him because he says nigga every 5 minutes. But you say nigga every 5 minutes. He's a rapper, you a rapper. What the fuck? You know, I've gotten into shit with black people who were defending their friend, their white friend. Hey, what's up, nigga? What's up? And it's like, hey, man, what the fuck is wrong with you? Oh, man, he's a friend of mine, man. It's cool. So, nah, it ain't fucking cool with me. I don't fucking know him. And I don't like you using nigga. What the fuck makes you think I'm going to be cool with him doing that shit? I don't fucking know him. You know, for those of you who know me, ask anybody that knows me. Don't come up to me sticking out your hand to shake, talking about, yeah, what's up, my nigga? Nah. Nah, I don't want to shake hands with a motherfucker that identifies himself that way. I don't want anything to do with black people who identify as niggas. No, I don't. That's why I don't want to hear your black power, black this, oh, I fuck swirling, or, you know, fucker. I don't want to hear it. Because I know the majority of you are motherfucking hypocritical sons of bitches that the first white woman you can goddamn get, you're going to go. You're gonna go. You're gonna go straight between her fucking legs, and then you're gonna come back out to the goddamn, you know, hood and talk about how you tricked some white chick into giving you some, and then you're gonna go back and try to see how much money you can get out of her, and all this type of bullshit. Scandalous motherfucking brother. But you know, you're doing something. You know, you're doing something for black people by doing that kind of shit. No, you ain't doing shit. Except wallowing in fucking bullshit, wallowing in your own fucking bullshit, wallowing in the bullshit that white people out here put out there for you. Like a pig wallowing in fucking dirt. Not because you're with a white woman, but because you're fucking just being stupid. Being fucking ignorant. And I'm sorry, Alice Walker's bullshit is fucking pure goddamn ignorance. It's ignorance. Give a fuck about her being black. I can't defend this bullshit. Oh, boy, he's going to act like that because he's Jewish. Nah, motherfucker. Nah, wrong is goddamn wrong. I stopped talking to a group of black folks some years back because they had a problem with chink. You know, because one African chick got into a fucking thing with a Chinese chick,
then, you know, the entire group then decided that all of China was bad. That every Chinese person in the United States was an anti-black hater. That's not fucking true. But you want to be racist, and you want to fucking talk about people slant the eyes and shit, and you want to talk about them eating rice when fucking Africans goddamn survive off rice. You know, to repeat the ugliness that you have fucking heard out here. You see, this particular incident that I'm talking about, I was there. This woman was making ridiculous fucking comments. And after the third one or so, the woman was like, you know what? I don't like you. You know, you're really fucking... I can't be racist. I'm black. She's making comments about slanty-eyed Asian folks, but I can't be racist because I'm black. Yeah, I lost money because I walked away from that goddamn project. I did not want to work with those people. I don't want to work with anybody that's a goddamn ignorant fucking pig. If you're going to be bigoted against Nazis. If you're going to be bigoted against fucking white supremacist motherfuckers. If you want to be bigoted against abusive motherfucking men. If you want to be a bigot. If you want to be a fucking bigot, you want to go out here and push your weight around. Why don't you go against the people who really fucking deserve it? You want to be a bigot against priests? I can see that. Do it. I was raised Catholic. I didn't have any problems. You know, I was an altar boy. I didn't have any problems. I had a good priest. But the fuck, if I'm going to sit here and say that this shit is not rampant, I'm sitting here saying that the Catholic Church should not fucking exist. It shouldn't have existed centuries ago. It should have been fucking destroyed. Centuries ago is an organization. But you can't say that to a lot of Catholics, especially if they're Spanish speaking, especially if they're from Italy or Ireland. They don't want to hear what you have to say. Filipinos? Catholicism? They don't want to hear what I just said. They don't want to hear it. They know I'm telling the truth, but they don't want to hear it. They don't want to hear it. And let's also fucking be honest about something. You know, we come from a culture, I'm talking about black people in the United States, that, you know, we think fast on our feet, and we can make up some bullshit to excuse or, you know, rationalize just about anything. I'm talking to somebody out there. He listens to the show. He knows what I'm talking about. You get caught wrong and then you try to, you know, flip the script and shit and try to turn it out the other person is fucking wrong, you know. And then when you're both wrong, you're both just wallowing in bullshit. So you got your Christian goddamn extremists and you got your Muslim fucking extremists. They're both idiots and they're both goddamn wrong. But then we're going to argue over who has the right. And then it's like, well, you know, this whole Strutzman's thing. Well, you know, well, black people have right to say black power, so they got the right to say white power. But white power is the reason that you have black power. And black power used to mean something. It meant community control. But see, now it doesn't mean anything at all. It just means standing around holding your fucking dick, looking at the punkish white guy that you can see, and talking shit, where there's a real fucking neo-Nazi standing right next to you, and you look in the opposite goddamn direction. Yeah, I've seen that too. Many a motherfucking time, where some Uncle Tom motherfucker like me challenges the goddamn Nazi. Does brother man support me? Does brother man stand next to me? No, brother man turns his motherfucking face and tries to walk away. He tries to distance himself from the situation. But let some, you know, little punk-ass white guy come over, total fucking hipster trendy. You know, we're about 5'2". We know the motherfucker can't fight to save his goddamn life. That's who they want to riff against. That's who you motherfuckers standing on the corner. That's who you want to motherfucking fight. Where you can go online in any goddamn time and fucking know exactly where the Nazis are going to fucking be. Right? You know, I mean, you got the Proud Boys. Are they done now? Since their leaders, I guess the Don is gone, so that's the end of the motherfucking gang, right? So, you know, he's been, McGinnis. He's been all over the place, demanding violence, perpetuating violence, promising violence, demanding violence from the Trump crowd, more violence, saying that they're not being violent enough, because Matthew Heimblock and shit wasn't violent enough. You know, he's on film pushing around a black person, a black woman at you. You know, and he's been at I don't know how many goddamn events where there's been black men talking shit. And what do? They look at him and don't do nothing. And don't tell me it's because the cops are standing there or whatever. I've seen motherfuckers get shot in front of the goddamn cops by rivals. So I don't want to hear it. Because, see, you know, black men can go after black men over bullshit. any goddamn day of the week. No motherfucking sense of the repercussions. No give a fuck about the repercussions in terms of yourself or your family. But when it comes to motherfucking, you know, going after white power, what do you do? You don't do a motherfucking thing. You just talk a whole lot of shit. I mean, that's Farrakhan's fucking whole gig. You know, oh, well, Farrakhan defends the community. He's out there speaking up. He's not saying a goddamn thing I haven't been saying on this show over the past 14, 16 fucking years. It's like, what the hell? What? Anybody can go on a fucking platform. Anybody can get a soapbox and say, well, yeah, you know, racism's bad. You know, white people fucked up. What is he doing about it? He's taking your money and putting that shit in the Cayman Islands, goddamn. That's what he's doing with your fucking money. He lives on the white side of goddamn Chicago in the motherfucking mansion. That's what he's doing with your money. You know, go through the archives of Ebony Magazine when they went through his house and did that layout. And you can see the gold tapestries and all that expensive shit. It looks like Trump's house. One of Trump's houses. Any one of Trump's houses. Right? Because he's not doing work in the White House. He's playing golf and shit. So, you know, it's like if you want to know where your motherfucking money's going, where the whole impetus of that bullshit is going, is in his motherfucking pocket. And yeah, I don't want to hear nothing. You know, I mean, I'm looking at MSNBC and the Reverend Al Sharpton's got a goddamn TV show. After selling out Assata Shakur, after selling out three other members of the motherfucking Black Panther Party for self-defense, you know, after snitching on the mafia, now he's, you know, after fucking causing all that crazy shit about, what is her name? Help me here, Luke. The young girl who faked being kidnapped and attacked over in New York State some years back. Because I just got into heat about this shit not too long ago. People are still believing her, Tawana Brawley. She lied. I was one of the goddamn people in fucking Newark, New Jersey, standing out there in the goddamn rain in fucking City Hall, defending her. There were black people all over this fucking country standing out in all kinds of goddamn weather, taking all kinds of fucking abuse from police over a lie. Do black women get attacked? That's right. Every fucking day in this goddamn country. There's more than 1,600 indigenous fucking women missing in this fucking country. There's young black women missing in fucking the United States every goddamn day. But a lie is a fucking lie. And Tawana Brawley fucking lied. And what makes it terrible is that I've had people fucking say to me on Twitter, I've had people say to me face to face, even if she did lie, it doesn't matter, we should be defending her anyway because black women get attacked. That is not how you do. If that's your politics, stop listening to this broadcast. I don't want you fucking here. If that's your attitude, I don't want anything to fucking do with you. Go the fuck away. So what you're saying is, they're liars, but if we lie, then it's just as good. And if we build on that lie, well then it doesn't matter because they built everything up on a lie, so it's all good. No, it's not. No, it's not good. And now we're in a political situation where, you know, Alice Walker's bullshit is going to be used against black people. It's going to be used against the boycott, divestment, and sanctions goddamn movement, which is backed by quite a number of black people. This is going to be bad. Farrakhan was bad enough. But the thing is, Farrakhan is fringe. Alice Walker's not goddamn fringe. Which just goes to show what I've been saying, that this shit is not fringe. This fucking crazy Judeophobic bullshit that y'all are pushing is only helping the goddamn white supremacists. This is what they want. And you're doing them a fucking favor. And you're doing it for free because there's no political fucking gain for this, from it. There is nothing for you to get out of this. Zero. Except more goddamn confusion. Now, there is one thing if you're going to stand against the state of Israel because it's the colonialist empire. It's one thing if you're going to stand against Israel because of the genocide they're perpetuating against the Palestinian people and the racism that they're perpetuating against Ethiopians who have immigrated there, that they pretty much pushed the fucking immigrate there, and then when they tried to actually come in the country, they blocked them. So then you had to actually have a movement of Jews to support the Ethiopian Jews in order to fucking come into the goddamn country.
Betelgeuse, right? So, you know, here we are in a fucking situation. In a really ugly, stupid, and totally preventable goddamn situation. Alice Walker has lost her fucking mind. If she believes that there's a real fucking race of lizard people that are running shit, and I have to admit this because I saw this online. It's on YouTube probably if you go look for it. And no, don't bother to pull it up because I don't want to see it. But David Icke went to Africa because they do this. Alex Jones, I think, did the same thing. And what they do is they go to, they find, you know, the one black person that's willing to talk to them, to tell them some kind of crazy shit. I mean, this happened with the Dogon people. The Dogon people could never see any motherfucking planet over there. You know, that was a complete fabrication made up by an Italian who was trying to make a name for himself. And a couple of people in the Dogon fucking nation ran with this because they didn't know what else to do. Here's this white guy coming over there being really friendly, telling them this shit. Yeah, and they just went along with it. It's a hoax. The whole goddamn thing about the Dogon and being able to connect with people from Beta 1 and Beta 2 Reticuli is nonsense. It's nonsense. And the Russian Internet Research Agency knew this. Let me read this real quick because Lupe's pulled it up for you. We're going to go out with this. Now, the report is titled The IRA and Political Polarization in the United States. And we're going to put a link to this with the podcast. But according to this report, Russia's Internet Research Agency, otherwise known as IRA, launched an extended attack on the United States by using computational propaganda to misinform and polarize U.S. voters. This report provides the first major analysis of this attack based on data provided by social media firms to the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. So, this is a federal fucking report. And I'll say it again, the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, or SSCI. I mean, it's pretty fucking bad, man. You think I should read it all? Okay, we're going to go out with this. I'm going to read it all out here. Like I said, we're going to link to this. And now the report there's a bunch of names down here, you read it. But between 2013 and 2018, the IRA's Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter campaigns reached tens of millions of users in the United States. Over 30 million users between 2015 and 2017 shared their Facebook and Instagram posts with their friends and families. I mean, you know, but here's what we really want to get now. Because we need to go. Russia's IRA activities were designed to polarize the U.S. public and interfere in elections by campaigning for African-American voters to boycott elections. Did you hear that? Campaigning for African-American voters to boycott elections or follow the wrong voting procedures in 2016, and more recently for Mexican-American and Hispanic voters to distrust U.S. institutions. To encourage extreme right-wing voters to be more confrontational, and spreading sensationalist, conspiratorial, and other forms of junk political news and misinformation to voters across the political fucking spectrum. Are you satisfied? Black Agenda goddamn report said that anybody who believes this sort of thing, and this is way before this report was fucking conducted, this is when I was saying that this shit was happening, before I even had any definitive proof, just because I have seen it before. I've been doing politics my whole fucking life. I've seen this. I've worked on campaigns. I've seen this before. A Black Agenda report, which gets respect from Bob Kincaid, right? You know, from a lot of white progressives. I've been trying to say this shit. So, well, they got something to say. Bob Kincaid and I had a disagreement about this on the air. No, the Black Agenda report doesn't have shit to fucking say. And I said that on his goddamn broadcast. I said it over the air. They don't have a fucking thing to say. They were part of this. They were part of this. CPR Metro, the communist bullshit out of upstate New York, they were part of this too. On both of those programs, if you go through the, if you fucking tooth comb them, what's that? Yeah, if you tooth comb these motherfuckers, if you go through all of them, you will hear, oh, they're just trying to take Trump down. They're just against Trump. Both of those programs, that they'll say anything to get rid of this president. But see, they'll say that in the middle of like, you know, a good 10 or 15 minutes of how bad the system is, and then they'll say something like that, and then go back to saying, well, yeah, the system is bad. While they just defended the goddamn system. While they defended the motherfucking main agent of the system, the main cause of the fucking controversy that they're complaining about. So, yeah, black folks, black America, we're in a lot of trouble. We're in a lot of trouble. And Alice Walker, I mean, I don't know what to say to you, sis. Actually, I will know what to say to you if you come on this broadcast. I mean, if you're willing, like I said, if anybody wants to, you know, y'all like to start beef, right? You know, because this is how adult you motherfuckers are. Y'all like to start shit. So, I'm going to go ahead and help you out. If you want to fucking tell Alice Walker, you want to send her an email, you want to send her a copy of this fucking broadcast, you can tell her she's welcome to come on this motherfucking show and explain to me why it makes sense for her to fucking back a motherfucker who claims to be God, literally. A motherfucker who claims that there's lizard people who are actually controlling the fucking world and that they're actually Jews that are doing this shit. She can come on and explain to me how this makes any motherfucking sense. Because I'm open to the goddamn discussion. I'm open to discussing nonsense. I'm open to pointing out nonsense when I fucking see it. Because I tell you, ladies and gentlemen, if you know anything about me, if I'm listening to the show, or know anything about me in my personal life, when I smell bullshit, I go for the fucking jugular. Bullshit gets people fucking killed. Bullshit perpetuates more fucking bullshit. Bullshit leads to wars. Bullshit leads to genocide. Bullshit leads to fucking us turning our blind eye to craziness, like what's happening in the fucking White House right now, that we know is fucking crazy, by thinking that if we bring Clinton back in 2000, for 2020, that's going to fix it. That if Nancy Pelosi gets back into her position, that's going to fix it. That if Chuck Schumer stays where he's at, that's going to fucking fix it. Because see, part of this report is, I had people who were giving me all kinds of, you know, I'm not going to vote for them. I'm not going to, you know, in the primaries, like the Dems, I'm not going to back Bernie Sanders. Because, you know, he's just an old Jew. I'm not going to back Bernie Sanders. You know, why would I support an old Jew? What does his being Jewish have the fucking thing to do with his policies? Didn't have a goddamn thing to do with his fucking policies. Nothing. Nothing. You know, Black Lives Matter made a really stupid political fucking game. You know, they attacked Bernie Sanders instead of attacking Clinton. And when they did attack Clinton, they did so, you know, with kid gloves, with the idea that we'll make a deal with Clinton. And then Clinton fucked them. And turn right around talking about bringing them to heel. Okay, so, you know, no. Nah, you motherfuckers, I'm telling you, man. The U.S. left, black Americans, you're all on notice. You better wake the fuck up, because this shit is getting real bad, and fuck it, it's going to get worse. It's going to get fucking worse. When you got Diamond and Silk shilling for a fucking neo-Nazi, and then you got Alice Walker siding with neo-Nazis, and Omarosa trying to pretend that she wasn't working for a neo-Nazi, yeah, we got problems. This is the Angry Indian, and you are listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. This is the Angry Indian, and you are still listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. We're going to take a break so stations may identify themselves. Please, stay tuned.
This is Rebecca Pierce. I'm a journalist and filmmaker from the San Francisco Bay Area. You can find me at weirdsister.tv, and this is Aboriginal Radio.
Folk don't like Farrakhan. Some of them respect me. But those who have been our deceivers, they can't stand me. I'm not mad with you. In fact, to the members of the Jewish community that don't like me, thank you very much for putting my name all over the planet because of your fear of what we represent. I can go anywhere in the world and they've heard of Farrakhan. Thank you very much. I'm not mad at you. Because you're so stupid. Don't you know? My teacher, Elijah Muhammad, taught me one day. He said there once was a donkey that fell in the ditch. And everybody came along, they picked up a stone and threw it at the donkey. They threw so many stones till the ditch got filled up and the donkey walked out. So my teacher said, brother, remember, every knock is a boost. So when they talk about Farrakhan, call me a hater. You know what they do? Call me an anti-Semite. Stop it. I'm anti-termite. I don't know nothing about hating somebody because of their religious preference. Reconciliation is a necessity.
Yes, sir.
Whenever you've hurt your brother or your sister, the only way you can reconcile differences, you got to know when you have done something wrong. And don't be afraid to admit it when you know you're wrong. It takes courage to go to somebody that you have wronged and ask for forgiveness.
But you can't. I assume, given the fallout that ensued in your description of Judaism as a dirty religion, will move you never to use that phrase again.
I think someone in the audience said it right. Shame, shame, shame.
Shame on who?
On you.
On me?
Yes, because you keep repeating the big lie.
Right.
The lie that's told over and over and over and over again.
No, I have said over and over again.
Jews and blacks and others believe that I actually said that. Let me.
You didn't say that?
No, I did not.
Now you're going to accuse me of taking this out of context.
No, I'm not either.
I'm going to play your own voice. I did this before. You're accusing me of taking it out of context. This is Chuck. This is number three. Let me just say, Minister Farrakhan,
sure.
I don't get any. This is no joy to be going around the block with you again on this. But when you when you smile, it conveys a kind of, oh, stop worrying about this. I know what I meant. This is not the precision of language that we would expect from a man whose mind is so admired by the last person who stood up.
Well,
now let's. Here we go again. Roll the tape. Here is your voice and the words. Graphic.
Never had any peace in 40 years, and he will never have any peace because there can be no peace structured on injustice, thievery, lying, and deceit, and using the name of God to shield your better religion under his holy and righteous name.
To shield your gutter religion under his holy and righteous name.
Now,
you said that. That's your voice.
I want to say that no sane, intelligent, religious person could ever condemn the revealed word of God from the source of purity as dirty or gutter or unclean. The word of God comes to people in the gutter to purify their actions and their conduct and cause them to live upright. But religion is not what we preach. Religion was and is what we practice. And that's why Moses told Israel, obey the Lord.
This is Radio Anglo-Indian. Anglo-Indian radio for the fourth world.
Please note, if you experience difficulty with a cassette,
Please hold it flat in the palm of your hand and slap it smartly against a hard, flat surface. If this does not work, call the customer service number shown on the package for a replacement. Discard the broken cassette.
तपाईलाई थाहा छ नेपालमा पहिलो पटक कहिले एचआईभी संक्रमित व्यक्ति फेला परेको थियो
थाहा छ सन् 1988 मा
यतिका वर्ष बितिसक्दा एचआईभी एड्स को क्षेत्रमा के भए सकारात्मक परिवर्तनहरू कति आए कसले के गरे
के हामीले आफ्नो जिम्मेवारी बहन गर्यौं तपाईले गर्नुभयो
जवाफ आफैसँग खोजौं जिम्मेवारी बहन गरौं
सामाजिक रूपान्तरणका लागि गगन गृहको एउटा प्रयास
I Don't Know More calls all people
to join in peaceful revolution
to honor indigenous sovereignty
and protect the land and water
for generations to come
Mexicans, South Americans, all indigenous people get inspired
take action
and become a part of the solution
It's my future
your future
our future
We are the protectors of Mother Earth
Stand up and protect it
Stand up and protect it
Stand up
and protect our earth
Do not sit.
Do not sit.
Do not sit.
Do not sit.
And become a part of this incredible movement.
The time has come.
Idle no more.
Idle no more.
Idle no more. Become idle no more.
Yo, what's up? My name is Jasiri X, you know what I'm saying? And I'm really responding to the call, man, of my sister Rosa Clemente, you know what I'm saying? For Men in Hip Hop, really stand up and say, like, rape under no circumstances is acceptable. You know what I'm saying? Rape shouldn't be rapped about. It shouldn't be supported. You know what I'm saying? And I'm really feeling like, you know, especially after Rick Ross came out today and said what he said, you know, he didn't use the word rape, but he described a scenario in which, you know, he put something in a woman's drink and had sex with her and she didn't consent. If you have sex with a woman and she didn't consent, that's rape. And we have to say no to rape. And beyond Rick Ross, whether it's Fox News or their viewers attacking Zelina Maxwell for asking men to stop raping women, whether it's Hollywood, you know, perpetuating, you know, this rape culture, you know, it's got to stop. And it's really, you know, we got to take personal responsibility as men. My name is Jasiri X. This is One Hood.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson from Normal. For 30 years, Normal has provided a voice for the millions of Americans who smoke marijuana responsibly. Thousands of sick and dying patients find marijuana effective as a medicine, including cancer, MS, and AIDS patients. 9 states have legalized its use. To learn how you can help, contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORML.
Welcome back. Let's go now to an exhibition in Jerusalem that is spotlighting a crucial moment in Israeli history. Of course, you've probably heard of the American Black Panther Party. That's an important part of African-American history in the late 1960s. But did you know that a group with the same name also existed in Israel? Not only that, but they came to define politics in the Jewish state for decades. Our culture correspondent, Maya Margit, has the story.
Welcome to Israel in the 1970s, a time of social upheaval, war, and major terror attacks, when economic inequality festered and civil rights movements were born. Enter the Israeli Black Panthers, a protest group modeled after the African-American group of the same name. Jewish immigrants from North Africa, or Mizrahis, banded together to bring attention to their dire social and economic situation.
We copied the name from the American Black Panthers. We began to hear what they were doing in the U.S. and how African Americans were protesting against injustices. We became just like them. We, the Mizrahim, were just like the blacks in the U.S. and we saw the European Jews as being like the whites in the U.S.
Photographer Yaakov Shofar spent years with the Israeli Black Panthers, conducting extensive interviews and shooting portraits of leading members.
Israel was going through a very difficult period in the 1970s. There were many terror attacks, there was the Yom Kippur War, protests. The media depicted the Black Panthers always protesting and threatening the rule of law, but I wanted to show their human side.
After disappearing from public view for over 30 years, these startling pictures are now on display. It's all part of an exhibition at the Israel Museum in Jerusalem, titled Born in Israel.
It was important for us to do this show because we hear a lot about the status of Mizrahi culture in the context of Israel or Israeli society today.
The show is just one reminder of how the Black Panthers movement, which began in a small Jerusalem neighborhood named Musrara, came to define an era in Israeli history.
There were houses in Musrara where 10 people were living in the same room. The schools were not schools. Each classroom had 150 students or more. Sewage flowed in the middle of the streets. There was barely any water or electricity. There was nothing organized or fixed in that neighborhood.
Much like the American Black Panthers, the Israeli group focused on poverty and ethnic tensions. They would protest against racial discrimination, often clashing with police, and getting arrested on a regular basis.
In order to suppress them, the state turned the Israeli Black Panthers into criminals. They used the police to arrest them and put them in prison, and this is where the members of the group got their best education. They came to distrust Israeli authorities completely.
The people depicted in Yaakov Shofar's photo descended into the world of drugs. Instead of being able to develop themselves, they were destroyed, and some of them turned into complete train wrecks.
After years of photographing the Black Panthers, Shofar abandoned his art career and disappeared off the cultural map.
After I took these pictures, I stopped doing photography altogether for many years, because this project squeezed the life out of me. It was a tremendous mental effort.
As for Biton, he believes discrimination against Mizrahi Jews remains a major problem in Israel, one that a new and younger generation will have to remedy.
The state of Israel has a very important mission to show the world that we are a different nation with a unique purpose. We want to be a light unto the nations, so therefore we cannot be racist or discriminate and treat Ethiopians or Mizrahi Jews the way they are being treated.
Born in Dusseldorf, and that is why they call me Rolf.
Don't be stupid, be a smarty. Come and join the Nazi party.
Hey, this is Rala Mata.
And Donna from EPSI.
And you're listening to a...
Creative Commons licensed podcast.
Word.
These are Manfred and Leo Friedman. They are my first cousins. Not distant relatives, first cousin. A few months after this picture was taken, 75 years ago, the Nazis put them on a train and then exterminated them, like vermin. They might have been saved if the U.S. had approved their parents' application to emigrate, but it didn't, because Americans thought Jews were shifty and dangerous. For some people in the White House, the Holocaust exists only in the history books. For the Jewish people, it is a collective national trauma. But along with Manfred and Leo and their parents, the Nazis murdered my grandparents, my aunts, my uncles, my cousins, and countless other relatives. So for me, and for many other Jews, the Holocaust is still very, very personal, each and every day. Which is why I felt that, in recent days, the White House bashed my head in 3 times in a row. First, when President Trump's ban on Muslims brought back painful family memories of America's locked gates. Second, because the Holocaust is first and foremost about Jews, Manfred and Leo, along with 6 million others, were murdered because they were Jews, but the White House erased Jews from its Holocaust Day statement. And third, because White House spokesman Sean Spicer had the chutzpah to describe complaints about the omission as pathetic nitpicking and to proclaim that Trump had gone out of his way to mark Holocaust Day. In other words, the Jews should be grateful and shut their mouths. But I'll tell him what's truly pathetic. One, that the White House, hopefully out of ignorance, tried to minimize the centrality of Jews in the Holocaust, like some Holocaust deniers. Two, that its excuse for doing so is a perverse kind of political correctness of trying to be, and I quote, incredibly inclusive. Three, that rather than apologize or admit a mistake, the president's automatic response is attack, attack, attack. Four, that the administration still can't comprehend how much it hurts so many Jews, especially in America. And five, that Trump believes that support for Israeli policies or that a Jew was involved in writing the statement makes everything better. But I'll tell you what's really pathetic, that Israel didn't say a word, that Prime Minister Netanyahu and his ministers would have torn Obama apart if he dared do something similar, gave in to political expediency, cowardice, and just plain indifference. That was truly pathetic and hurtful and very, very personal.
Hello, I'm Carol Warden. The Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center asked for your help in spreading awareness of the National Public Awareness Campaign for the availability of Plan B within Indian Health Service. Plan B is an emergency contraceptive that is routinely denied to Native women at IHS facilities. Although Plan B has been available without a prescription for adult women since 2006 and as of 2009 available to women age 17 and up, it is still not provided over-the-counter at 90% of IHS pharmacies. Our goal is to ensure that Plan B is available as an over-the-counter contraceptive for all Native women and to incorporate access to Plan B into standardized sexual assault policies within IHS. We also seek to inform Native women of their right to Plan B so that they are able to make informed decisions regarding their reproductive health. Please help us get the word out. Native women are entitled to the same level of health care as all other women. This message is brought to you by the Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center.
Radio Insurgente, la voz de los sin voz.
Vamos, 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 vamos adelante, para que salgamos en la lucha avante, porque nuestra patria grita y necesita de todo el esfuerzo de los zapatistas.
Transmitiendo desde algún lugar de las montañas del sureste mexicano, en la frecuencia 97.9 en FM.
Missy Elliott for the Black AIDS Institute.
HIV happens to us more than it does anybody else, which is why we should all get tested, because if we don't step up, then nobody will.
Get informed. tested, get treated, and get involved. For more information, call the Black AIDS Institute at 213-353-3610. That's 213-353-3610. Or online at www.blackaids.org.
So this is Jen Gorlick. I'm an activist in D.C. I support a free and unoccupied Palestine, and you're listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
I want to give my thanks to the organizers of this to invite me here. Are most of you law students? Some of us, okay. I was supposed to talk about political repression and the legal system. And I will, but I think I like to put things in a historical context. I think that one of the things that we really should try to understand is that we are living in a historical moment. And this historical moment requires of us some degree of analysis, of introspection, and of self-realization, if you will. Earlier today, I did an interview. We were talking about things such as the Black Panther Party, the political repression of the Black Panther Party, etc. Many people have the idea and the notion that the Black Panther Party was a failure, that the Black Panther Party didn't succeed, and that it was, in many respects, and this comes from a lot of black academicians who were hating on the party because many of them were cultural nationalists in the 60s, and they were wearing their dashikis and afros, and they thought their dashikis were bulletproof. And so a lot of them have this perception of the Black Panther Party as gun-toting street Negroes, street blacks with guns, who had no political analysis and who had no understanding of what they were really doing. They were just hating on the police. And many of you who are young, who were not around in the 60s, probably have read much of that in the documentation that you've read on the Black Panther Party. But you need to ask yourself, how is it that an organization that only existed for 4 or 5 years, in actuality, was able to transcend generations, still remembered by people around the world, still inspiring people and students to study and stand up and struggle? Many students and many people that I have encountered hardly remember SNCC, Student Nonviolent Organization Committee, hardly remember SCLC, CORE, all vital organizations in the struggle of African people for human rights in this country. But they remember the Black Panther Party. Even though their memory or how its accounts of its history have been distorted, they remember that. And why is that? You need to ask yourself, why is that? And the reason is not because the Black Panther Party had an answer to everything, or that they were especially revolutionary, they were so dynamic as revolutionaries that the U.S. government actually feared the overthrow by the Black Panther Party. That wasn't it at all. What was it? The United States of America, in 1967, in 1968, in 1969, in 1970, was in a historical moment. And the Black Panther Party found themselves at the cutting edge of that historical moment. Now, what historical moment am I talking about here? In 1968, the United States was undergoing a period of civil tumult. In Islam, we call it fitna. The United States was facing urban rebellions throughout the nation every year. Hundreds of cities were going up in smoke. Black people were demonstrating for human rights and civil rights in the streets. The image of the United States abroad was the image of a hypocritical nation that talked about freedom and democracy and equality, but yet the world was treated to the images of dogs attacking peaceful demonstrators, police beating women and children in the streets. The image of the United States was at its all-time low. But at this particular point, the United States was still empire. It was still developing the consolidation of what we have today, or what I call the national security state. The national security state wasn't completed in 1969. The consolidation of the right wing in America and white supremacy in America had undergone and was undergoing a severe challenge. What was this challenge? This challenge was for human rights, was for human dignity, was anti-imperialism. The streets of America were filled with anti-war demonstrators, hundreds of thousands of them. Young children, much like yourselves, the children of white America were fleeing the country, going to Canada to avoid the draft. There was an involuntary military draft, in effect. The United States as an empire had an army that was constituted of draftees, conscripts. And it was fighting a war in Vietnam that was unpopular. And President Lyndon Baines Johnson at the time, in 68, right before the Tet Offensive, said that the United States was turning the corner in Vietnam. He had authorized sending 50,000 more troops to Vietnam that very year. And he had said that he had been promised by his military leaders and his military advisors that the United States was turning a corner in Vietnam and that the Viet Cong and the communists were defeated. We were seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. But you heard the metaphor, the light at the end of the tunnel is what? Be careful. It's an oncoming train. So Lyndon Baines Johnson told the American people that we were winning the war in Vietnam. This is 1968. And lo and behold, by December of 1968, the Viet Cong, so-called Viet Cong, the National Liberation Front for the Liberation of South Vietnam, and the North Vietnamese People's Army launched the Tet Offensive. And in hundreds of hamlets and towns and cities across Vietnam, the North and the Viet Cong took control. And this was transmitted into the living rooms of American people. They saw the Vietnamese in the U.S. Embassy in Saigon just weeks after Lyndon Baines Johnson had said that the war was won. It forced Walter Cronkite to issue his first statement condemning the war in Vietnam. Much like the media today in Iraq, in terms of Iraq and Iran, the media was a cheerleader of the Vietnam War. It encouraged the elites of America to wage this imperialist war. So 68, when the Viet Cong launched the Tet Offensive, and the streets of America were filled with rebellious youth protesting the war, black people protesting second-class citizenship. In France and in Europe, the students were going on strike. In France, for instance, the students went on strike, and the French workers went out in sympathy with them in 1968. And it closed down the whole French Republic. It threatened the very existence of France as a republic. At the same time that this was happening in 1968, liberation movements in Africa were beginning to get support and aid from the United States Cold War enemy, the Soviet Union, and were beginning to show headway in the liberation struggles in Africa, defeating the imperialists almost at every turn. All of these events in 1968 came together to bring onto the world stage and onto the national stage Richard Milhouse Nixon. Lyndon Baines Johnson, after the Tet Offensive, said he would not run for president again. And he stepped down. leaving the door open to the Republican Party and Richard M. Nixon. Now, Richard M. Nixon, of course, we all know, had a history of red baiting and anti-communism. But Richard M. Nixon was no fool. He was a consummate politician, and he knew that in 1969, in that period, 68, 69, and 70, that he had to gain control of social culture in the United States. Political control of culture, political control of society, legal control of its citizens. Now, we have to remember that in 1968, SWAT teams didn't exist. Did you know that? You always thought they were SWAT teams, right? SWAT teams didn't exist in 1968. In 1968, for instance, to give you an example, and this is very important to understand, you had major urban areas such as New York City, Chicago, San Francisco, LA, New Orleans, that had some of the most corrupt police departments in the country. The New York City Police Department was one of the most corrupt police departments in America, as the Knapp Commission and the Serpico story would come out and prove. It was the Black Panther Party in New York City and in Chicago and in San Francisco that started organizing in the African community for community control of the police. Community control of the police. Not decentralization of the police, but community control. And community control meant that the people in the community would control the policies and the standards of the local police department. That they would impose a residency clause, that the police should come from the community that they worked in. Because most of the African communities were policed by white policemen who didn't live in the city, who didn't live in the community. They were an occupying army in the black community. And their sole purpose in the black community was not to defend African people from criminal activity, but to impose the status quo's will on people of African ancestry, to brutalize them, to murder them in the name of the law. You have to remember that to this very day, the United States does not admit to having political prisoners. To this very day, 20 or so years after COINTELPRO, America has no political prisoners. But I'm going to come to that for the benefit of our law students. But for the benefit of those who are a little more eclectic in their studies, I want to point out to you that this period of time, 68, 69, 70, marked a crucial period in America's transition from a bourgeois democracy to democratic fascism that we have today. So when Richard Nixon came into power, he saw all of this turmoil and tumult in America, and he says, well, we got to get control. Lacking a national police force, what was he to do? The FBI under J. Edgar Hoover was conducting a covert program called the Counterintelligence Program that initially started, its first practices were initially carried out against Marcus Mosiah Garvey, the head of the United Negro Improvement Association. Now, without going into the history of the UNIA and Garvey, suffice it to say that the techniques of the counterintelligence program that were to be developed in the 50s against the Communist Party, and that was used against black nationalists in the before World War I and after World War I and in between the wars, these techniques were first used and utilized on the plantations in the United States. Simple techniques, you know, hanging people from trees, you know, death of a thousand cuts, waterboarding. Y'all just heard of that. Crackers used to do that to Africans on the plantation on a regular basis. It's nothing new. These techniques all existed. These techniques of torture, divide and conquer, internalization of hatred to the point of self-hatred. All of these techniques, you know, more than two Negroes in one place at a time constituted the conspiracy. The only time Africans were allowed to get together were in church on Sundays, or at, you know, Catfish Row on Sundays. And who they had to listen to? They had to listen to the minister. And you know how that turned out. We wound up with Jesse today. We're still listening to ministers. But having said that, these techniques of the counterintelligence program, divide and conquer, misinformation, defamation of character, arrest and coercion, physical violence, intimidation, terrorism, were all techniques that were employed in the antebellum South. But they developed and changed as America developed and changed. And by the 1960s, 1950s, America was undergoing a process of urbanization and the development of a global technological infrastructure. These developments, urbanization of America, the war in Vietnam, the migratory patterns of American working people, the struggles of African people for human rights, the struggles of women for their rights, the anti-war sentiments in the country, all constituted a nation about to explode. So when Richard Nixon ran for office, he ran on the ticket that he represented who? The silent majority. They weren't in the streets demonstrating. They weren't protesting the war. They weren't demanding better working wages. They weren't doing none of these things. There was a silent, suffering majority. You know, the same ones that Sarah Palin calls the real Americans. Same crew. I used to say back then, the silent majority, every time I drove past the cemetery, I said, there's Nixon's silent majority. But he ran on this ticket that he was representing the American people. He was representing the people who didn't have a voice, who weren't out in the street demonstrating, who were hardworking people. Middle America. You know, Pabst Blue Ribbon, red neck, white socks. Red, white, and blue. He represented them. But his problem was he didn't have a national police force to repress all of this protest and all of this movement. And you remember, those of you who've seen all the movies and stuff about the counterculture, you know about the hippie movement, right? You know about the counterculture, the Timothy Leary version of history, you know, tune in, tune out, you know, turn on, tune out. 1967 was the summer of love. Demonstrators were sticking flowers down National Guard barrels and, you know, gun barrels. This was the summer of love. This was a period where counterculture was beginning to supplant the mainstream culture, especially amongst the youth. And a consequence of this, of course, was that young whites began to interact more with black people on a very fundamental level. You know, like smoking weed together. Freaking out at concerts, listening to Jimi Hendrix bug out and play the guitar backwards. You know, jumping up and down like a puppet, you know, to the Doors. You know, even John Lee Hooker had a comeback. All the old blues musicians, Rolling Stones, were paying tribute to old blues. This was an era in which blacks and the culture of, quote, the counterculture began to come together. So Nixon was very shrewd. He said, well, we can't have this. This is getting out of control. So he ran on the ticket of representing the silent majority. He launched a war on drugs. He established an alliance with the Mexican government and began to spray the marijuana crops with Pacquiao, which was a form of Asian orange. He sprayed the marijuana crops with Pacquiao, Asian orange, and people started smoking that stuff when it came across the border and bugged out. But the war on drugs was Nixon's initiative. And what was the purpose of the war on drugs? To consolidate law enforcement. To politicize law enforcement. To give law enforcement the opportunity to acquire military skills for domestic repression under the guise of curtailing the importation of legal drugs. So he launched the war on drugs as soon as he came into office, and he established the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration, LEA, L-E-A-A. And LEA was designed to provide federal funding to local police agencies. If you had two black people in town, you qualified for anti-riot government subsidies. Didn't make a difference whether the two black people in town were two professors or not. You were qualified for federal funding to prepare your police department to deal with racial unrest. This was the purpose of the Law Enforcement Assistance Association. And it was out of this particular program that the SWAT team training, the relationship between the military and domestic police became regularized and institutionalized. It was out of the law enforcement, out of the LEA mandate that FEMA was formed. You all know about FEMA. I mean, all we have to do is just reflect back on Katrina, and we know about FEMA. But did we know that the Timothy McVeighs and the so-called right-wing all-Americans who support the Sarah Palins and the John McCains were all in state militias, began to become politicized in state militias that were given charters under the LEAA administration, under FEMA. State militias were supposed to be first responders in natural catastrophes. That was the facade that was put up. But who joined these state militias? Ex-Ku Klux Klansmen, Minutemen, right-wing John Birch Society types, ex-cops, military people, they all joined these militias. But remember, these militias were supposed to be for civil response to natural disaster. So under the pretext of providing government services for natural disasters, the Nixon administration put in motion the development of a police state in America. These were the kernels of the police state that we now see in America today. And you know what held up that development for 10 years? What do you think held up that development until 9/11? What do you think held up that development until 9/11? What do you think changed Nixon's plans? Forced them to modify his plans, delay much of them, and abandon some of their objectives. What do you think forced them to do that? In one word or in three words, organizations like the Black Panther Party. So you see, the Black Panther Party was eminently successful in its 4 or 5 years of existence. Its success lay in the fact that it delayed, if not postponed, the consolidation of fascism in the United States for at least 10 years. It was necessary for the government then to devise a new strategy to consolidate police power in the United States and to take away the civil rights of people in this country. As the national security state began to develop, and this is the same state that Eisenhower warned us of when he was leaving office in the 1950s. I don't know if any of you are familiar with Dwight D. Eisenhower. Any of you here familiar with Dwight D. Eisenhower? No? Yes? No? Because, you know, you got a young audience, you got to break stuff down for them. They think I'm talking about something that happened 100 years ago. This happened when I was your age. You thought it was some ancient history, right? Don't say that. I'm not that ancient. But this is recent history, and it's very important. You know, Dwight Eisenhower was the president of the United States. And for those of you who are unfamiliar with his track record, he was also the supreme commander of Allied forces in Europe. He's the one, amongst many generals, that led the United States effort against Nazi Germany in World War II. He was the supreme commander. And he went on to a political career and became president of the United States. And as he was leaving the office of presidency, as a military man, he advised the American people to beware of the military-industrial complex. Because this particular entity was the most threatening entity to your human and civil rights. The military-industrial complex. You know, and then he faded on into history. But he was right. What was developing in the 1950s during the Cold War, and you got to remember what the Cold War was. The Cold War was finance capitalism's attempt to deprive you of the resources necessary to change America. Trillions of dollars were spent in the Cold War, preparing for what? For a confrontation that never took place. Preparing for nuclear war. The United States spent trillions of dollars developing a nuclear arsenal that it would never use. Soviet Union likewise. The Cold War was a false dichotomy in the sense that the protagonists in the Cold War never fought each other. Never fired a shot at each other. They fought the wars in the Congo. They fought for territory and power in Mozambique, in Guinea-Bissau, in the Congo, in Somalia, in the Sudan, in the Middle East. But they never fired a shot at each other. And so they spent trillions of dollars terrifying Americans into believing that the Russian bear was just over the horizon and was about to attack America. And that if we had to be strong and we had to defend ourselves against this threat. I grew up in the Cold War. I was in junior high school and public school during the Cold War. And I remember when we used to hide under the desk during the fire drills. You know, if you have a fire drill here, what do? You orderly leave the building, right? You have to orderly leave the building, go outside, and stand in a place designated during a fire drill, right? Back then, that's not what happened. When the bell rang, you got under your desk because the Russians was coming. Serious. You don't remember these old flip-up desks? They used to have the part used to flip up where you could put your books in. Y'all don't remember. See, y'all got all this slick stuff, and you know, y'all, I don't remember none of that stuff. But I remember it. And we used to get under the desk until the all clear signal sounded. When all clear signal sounded, we came out. This false dichotomy, this Cold War, siphoned off trillions of dollars that could have went to develop America's infrastructure, that could have changed forever the lives of hundreds of thousands of people in the United States. It went for what? To the military, to the corporations that supplied the military with the technology they needed to maintain their supremacy and hegemony in the world. The Cold War. Trillions of dollars down the drain. And then all of a sudden, after Ronald Reagan's 2 terms in office, the Cold War is over. The Soviet Union collapses, and now America is supreme. Number one power in the world. And the American elite, their brain trusts and their think tanks write out this grandiose scheme of America in the 21st century. I don't know how many of you read it, but you need to go read it. America in the 21st century. And it talks about the United States military power and its supremacy and how this is unprecedented in the history of the world. Never before has there been such a thing. I remember Rome. I remember Babylon. We remember a lot of things, don't we? There's never been an empire on this planet that did not come and go. But the most important thing to understand is the process of empire. How does a nation develop into an imperial empire? How did the United States develop into an imperial empire? Of course, I'm willing to come back if the history professors invite me back to talk about this, and I'm quite sure I would provide you with some insights that you really didn't think about. But right now, I'm focused on the law students and their belief that somehow their career is going to effectuate change in this country. You know? And I want to talk about that because what developed from Richard M. Nixon's campaign to politicize the police departments, to create an atmosphere that would be conducive to the American people submitting to a police state, was very ingenious, and it took a period of time, but it worked. It worked. And what Richard M. Nixon did, despite the fact that, you know, he was hounded out of office, what he did was he created the foundation for what the Patriot Act would consolidate. Because in the Nixon administrations came up with the Omnibus Crime and Safe Street Act, which was an equivalent, a domestic version, sort of equivalent of the Patriot Act. You know, every time that the United States Empire is in crisis and it has to institute laws that the people know are against their better interests, It creates a terrorist persona, a threat from the outside, and then it passes legislation to address that threat. During the 50s in the Cold War, it was the McCarran Act. And the McCarran Act led to the House on Un-American Activities establishing a permanent committee. And if you, and you had to come before this committee, you were often summoned to this committee to declare your patriotism. I am not a communist. I believe in the United States of America and all of its stands, and I'm not a communist. Everybody had to come in front of McCarthy and the politicians that sat on the House on American Activities and explained themselves. People were purged from their jobs. People were stigmatized. Whole careers were ruined. The McCarran Act. So when Nixon came into office, he had to have his act too. What was it going to be, the Nixon Act? No. It was the Omnibus Crime and Safe Streets Act. Because remember what he said. He represented the silent majority. And who was in the streets? Protesters. Black civil rights demonstrators. Militants. They were all in the streets. So he forced through the Republican Party, with their majority at that time, forced through the Omnibus Crime and Safe Streets Act. And it was out of this act that a whole plethora of other institutions evolved, many of them we know today in different names. So Richard Nixon was very important and pivotal in creating the atmosphere and the basis for what was to come next. And what came next? After the Cold War was over, and the Russian bear was no longer the boogeyman, we turned our attention to what? Who became the pariah of world peace and security? What became the major force against imperialism? Was it Marxism-Leninism? We know that by the late 1960s, most of Africa was already independent. By 1973, they all were, except for maybe one or two provinces, because you know the Portuguese are stubborn and they held on to the last moment. But basically, Africa was liberated. Kwame Nkrumah was overthrown. So the idea of pan-African unity and the development of an African continent that was unified went the way of separate elites. To this very day, you have 53 African nations, and not one of them is a genuine African nation. Not one. They were all beholden to, clones of, imitations of European nation states. So we have come to a point in history when Richard M. Nixon ascended to power in the United States, where the United States was at a crucial turning point. It could move in either direction. It could move towards enlightenment and liberal change, empowering its people, providing for their people. Universal health care was possible in 1969. Because people had a better understanding of what socialism was and what it wasn't then. Now you ask the average American what is socialism, and they'll tell you Barack Obama. Barack Obama is a socialist. Y'all didn't know that, right? Y'all didn't know that. He's an undercover socialist. He's the only socialist that was financed by every major financial institution in the country. In his campaign, he raised more money than any other presidential candidate in history. History. He raised more money than Ronald Reagan and all of them combined. He was able to do that as an outsider. You know, he was basically an outsider. Nobody supported him. But he raised all this money. I know it all came from our piggy banks, right? Millions and millions of dollars came from our nickels and dimes that we contribute to the Obama dream. Yes, we can. Here's my dime. I'm down, give me the Kool-Aid. So, Richard M. Nixon, in 1968 and 1969, created the foundation that would go on to develop, you know, we had the brief episode of the peanut farmer and Jimmy Carter, you know, because after all of these excesses of an administration, there always comes in a liberal regime that vows to change everything. And that's what Jimmy Carter was supposed to do. He came in vowing to change everything. He even appointed, what's his name? Somebody give me some help here. You know, I can't remember all of these Negroes' names. You know, they just... Andrew Young, my man, Andy. He appointed Andy Young as the United States representative to the United Nations, and Andy thought he was really the United Nations representative to the UN, and he started talking to the Arabs. He started talking to the Palestinians. Yo, you know, we could work this out. The Zionist lobby went bananas. They went crazy. To the point where Jimmy Carter had to fire Andrew Young. Said he had no authorization to talk to the PLO and to Yasser Arafat and his organization. Of course, we know today that the United States does what? Talk to the PLO. In fact, they tell you the PLO is an integral part of the peace process. In fact, they are training the PLO security forces in order to keep in check who? Hamas. But we're coming to that in a moment. My point is, Richard Nixon, got to give Tricky Dick his due. Despite his shortcomings, despite his personal paranoia and insecurities, he laid the foundation for the modern police state that we are experiencing today and that we call democracy. The police departments of America were politicized during this period. Police associations became an integral part of the Republican and right-wing agenda. Their representation became important and essential. So by the time that Jimmy Carter came out of office and Ronald Reagan was elected to his first term, the great communicator had something to work with. He had something to work with. And it was Ronald Reagan's policies, domestic and foreign, that began to transform the gains that Richard Nixon had made, political gains on the right, into a movement and consolidated right wing. That would ensure his power for at least 8 years and would hound Bill Clinton for another 8 until we got George Bush the first. Then George Bush the second. This is getting boring, right? So where do we get these guys from? You know? And today, the peanut farmer is what? The foremost advocate of Palestinian liberation. Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter talks about Israeli apartheid. He visits the West, the Gaza Strip. He has a more cogent analysis of the situation in that part of the world than any of the people currently in office, including Barack Obama himself. This is Jimmy Carter, the same one that fired Andrew Young for talking to the Arabs. How come he wasn't like that when he was president? You notice how all these presidents, when they get out of office, they get militant. They get progressive. But when they was in office, they was quiet as church mice. You can hear a minute of protest. You look at your homeboy Barack. I know I shouldn't deal with him, right? I really should bypass him. But I can't bypass him completely because you have to understand that Barack Obama is the man of the historical moment. He was chosen. He was trained. He was groomed. Now, if you think I'm talking about some Illuminati or Society of the Skulls sitting in some room with ancient Roman symbolism saying, we're going to pick Barack Obama to represent imperialism and finance capital, so it shall be done. It wasn't that simple. I'm not an advocate of conspiracy theories. I just want you to know that up front. I believe it is what it is. I believe people can analyze and see things for what they are. I don't believe there was a group of men sitting around somewhere. It has to be men because we know about power and misogyny. There's a group of men sitting around, have sat around for the last 500 years determining which way Western civilization goes. And that's the way Western civilization has went in lockstep. It's not that happened. That's not happening. That's not what happened. History does create men and women, but men and women make history. And we are in a historical moment, and I'm repeating this over and over again because you must make history. You have to change the course of fascism in this country. You have to make this world a better place. And you are living in a historical moment where you have to do that now, because you have no other choice. So getting back to homeboy, the great communicator, he comes into office, and what is the first thing that he begins to do? He begins to propound a philosophy of capitalism that we've come to know as trickle-down prosperity. Ronald Reagan credited for building a strong U.S. military, right? A robust presence of America in the world. Here we have a nation, your nation, with 170-plus military bases around the world. Yet if you ask anybody in the administration from Obama on down, is the United States an imperial power? They'll tell you no. We're not an imperial power. So why you have 173 bases in 85 different countries and you ain't got nothing to do with imperialism? I mean, what's up with that? Well, the United States has interests. Last I heard, that was part of imperialism. National interests. Well, the United States has national interests. And its allies have an act. Now, who are the allies of the United States? Do you want me to get specific? Britain, Canada, Australia. You know, Germany, most of the times, after World War II, all the time. The French, ain't happening. Nepal. Glory was France. France used to be the beacon of Western civilization. And you've been to Paris, you know how arrogant the French are. Especially people of color, if you've been there, you know how arrogant. You have to cuss them out, slap them upside the face. That's the only way to start respecting them. They don't respect nobody else. So they have this cultural thing where they'll get down with the Americans and the British and the Canadians. But what I'm trying to point out is, with the exception of Germany after World War II, all of the wars and all of the battles that the United States has fought internationally has been in an alliance with other English-speaking colonies from Britain. English-speaking. You speak English? Speaking English? Yes, English-speaking countries. The United States has always marched lockstep with the manifest destiny of Great Britain. So it's not a coincidence, and you need to analyze that aspect of history, because it's very important understanding where we're at right now and how it is that the coalition of the willing is who? In Iraq. Britain? Who else? Canada? Who else? Australia. You know, New Zealand's in there too, you know. But they're like little junior partners. You know? Was the French in the coalition of the willing? Not overtly. The intelligence agencies were involved. Were the Germans in the coalition of the willing? Yes, but they only provided medical personnel. No combat people. Ever since the Germans got their ass whipped in World War II, they've been down with America since then. It's like the bully in the schoolyard. After he beat your butt, you always is yes man. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Tell him, Joe. Because he done whipped that butt so long ago, you know where the side of power lies. That's how the Germans are. You see? My point is that the geopolitics that we are beginning to experience today had their auspices in this period. And even before then, in the founding of the colonies and the liberation struggles that the colonies waged against their colonial homelands, the English-speaking people. You know, my wife asked me, she said she has a new professor, you know, at her, and you know, she's doing her courses and stuff. She has a new professor, and this new professor said that his major distinction, and this is a vignette, you know, I know I'm digressing, but here's a point to this. She has this new professor, and this professor told her that he's convening the class. He told her, well, you know, my major claim, I want y'all to know who I am. And he says, my major claim to fame, my major experiences, the two most important experiences in my life is I was struck by lightning. I was in a house that was struck by lightning twice. And I am an authority on terrorism for the CIA. I'm a consultant to the CIA on terrorism. So I said to her, why don't you ask this guy, what does one do to be a consultant on terrorism? How does one advise the U.S. government? What do? You go, I mean, you read books on terrorism? You go to the library, you Google terrorism. And then, you know, you research that. How do you deal with that? Do you go and join a terrorist cell and talk to the individuals who are involved in it? Or do you get involved in the movement so you could, how does one become an expert on terrorism? Because, you know, you got a lot of white boys that are experts on everything. That's how we got into this recession. You know, they're experts on this stuff. You remember Gold? You remember Gold? What is Gold? Gold? What's his name? Goldspan? Greenspan. I'm getting him mixed up with somebody. You remember Greenspan when he was asked, did he anticipate this reception? You remember? Did y'all see that? Y'all didn't see it on television. You got to go to YouTube or something and see this. Homeboy, now you got to remember, for decades, for over a decade, this man was considered the guru of finance capitalism. He was like everybody hung on his every word. It's like, so Mr. Goldspan, what do you think the economy will do in the next year? He was hanging on his words. So when they asked him, did you see this coming? Goldspan said, to be honest with you, I didn't have a clue. You got to see this guy say this. This guy said, I never thought or considered things happening this way. I felt, well, you know, we could control this and we could control that and we could regulate this. But this, I got to admit, I never saw it coming. So, for those of you in law school who are told you have to learn the history of the writ of mandamus and the writ of habeas corpus and where it comes from and the great Magna Carta and how it was a tribute to humanity and it was a curtailment of the arbitrary whim of nobility and all of that crap that y'all was told, you know, think again. It was written by people like Greenspan, who was clueless. Who were clueless. When you are in a historical moment, very seldom do you understand the moment that you're in. That's why we're having this meeting here. That's why we're here. It's very difficult to be in a situation like we are in and understand the forces that are at work against us. It's very, very difficult. That's why people make history, but history also makes people. Think of what would have happened if Russia, if the Germans invaded the Soviet Union and Stalin wasn't the dictator. Who you think would have won? There was only one person to his right that was more ruthless than him, and that was Joseph Stalin. And he's the one that saved the Soviet Union, whether you like it or not. If he was absent from the historical moment, me and you might be speaking German. Because if you remember, one battle on the Russian front equaled the entire force that was fielded on the Western Front. The Battle of Kertsch alone in the Soviet Union in 1943 had over 1.7 million soldiers on one side and 1.3 million on the other side. That's almost 3 million soldiers in one battle. Over 1,200 tanks on one side and 1,000 plus on the other. One battle. When you look at the Normandy invasion included less than 150,000 men initially. My point is that the great expenditure of resources and military power was used on the Russian front. If the Russian front didn't exist, the United States wouldn't have won the war. Or at least it wouldn't have won it in that fashion. So we need to ask ourselves, if you remove a person from history, what happens? Very important question. What happens? So you see that Obama, and my point is that the president that we have today, a black president, and you know, you have people crying and rolling around, black folks was like ecstatic when homeboy was elected. It's like, yes, we finally arrived. You know? Race is dead. The issue of race is dead. Americans, you know, George Will. I don't know if any of you are familiar with George Will. George Will is a right-wing political pundit who said upon the election of Barack Obama that his election was white people's emancipation. Was white Americans' emancipation, and it's true. White folks finally got rid of the onerous mantle of white supremacy because they elected a black president. They were no longer, you know, racist. You can't say that America is racist because they elected a black president. Well, I beg to differ. First of all, Obama is not the type of black person that white folks really are afraid of. Maybe Michelle's ancestors are, but not Barack. Barack Barack doesn't have any bullwhip days in his background. His ancestors weren't on the plantation getting lashed and waterboarded. His father came from Kenya. He was raised in Hawaii by white parents and went to Harvard Law School. How many black folks you know in Harvard graduated from Harvard Law School? And it was president of the National of the Harvard Law Review at that. Obviously, homeboys are gifted, intelligent, and very articulate individual. But hey, man, so was Adolf Hitler. He was gifted, intelligent, and a very articulate individual. I mean, he led the whole German people to perdition. You can't get no more rhetorically effective than that when you leave people. I mean, that's like Jim Jones. So we need to understand that Barack Obama, and you know, I had this politician, this black politician the other day tell me, well, America, the reason why whites voted for Barack Obama in such large numbers was because they were tired of George Bush. And that their world around them was collapsing. You know, Fannie Mae went belly up. You know, mortgages were going up. People were not having jobs. And, you know, so white Americans were suffering, like we all were suffering. We were all feeling this pressure. So Barack comes along with a message of change. And white folks said, well, we really don't know. This guy is black. So let's give him the litmus test. What's your relationship to Farrakhan? Please, you know I'm not down with Farrakhan. Okay, you was in this church with Reverend Wright. And this guy talked about goddamn America. Do you say that? Well, I can no more denounce Reverend Wright or deny Reverend Wright than I can black people. But I'm not limited by them. Next question. Oh, well, he's cool. He's not a black nationalist. He's not an undercover black Muslim. You understand? So he's cool. He passed the litmus test. Now, of course, if he would have said, well, I've been in this church of Reverend Wright's for years. My children have been in this church for years. And I think this is a moment when America should reflect on its history and white supremacy and racism and understand what Reverend Wright is saying. I challenge, you know, academia, white academia, to come and debate this issue about racism and what he is saying is true or not. He didn't say that. He said, homeboy, I ain't with that. You know, you on your own. Me? I'm just trying to get elected. So, Obama, just like Stalin, and I'm not saying that he has the same ideology or he is a dictator like Stalin. Let's not get this twisted here. I'm not comparing Obama to Hitler or Stalin. Because I know some of you will go away and write that. Bill Wahard came to Minneapolis and said that Obama was the same as Adolf Hitler. You think I'm joking? People would say that. And you're sitting here listening to me. Am I saying that? Am I saying that they are the same? I'm saying that the historical moment calls into existence the personalities and individuals that can take history to another level. That's what I'm saying. And be it villain or hero or shero, that historical moment does not discriminate. And so white America did not vote for Obama because he was black. They voted for Obama because he represented the American dream. Dreams of my father, not nightmares of my ancestors. You see, he wasn't going to wake up in the White House with a historical moment and say, man, these are the same people that murdered and killed my ancestors. Let me call the 1st Air Force in and have them bomb the capital of Alabama. He wasn't going to get a flashback like that because it wasn't in his DNA. So white folks knew that what they were voting for was dreams of my father. Such a wonderful story. I mean, Hallmark, Disney could tell this story. It's a beautiful story. Father in the village in Kenya, and I could hear the music. And there's this father, you know, dreaming and wanting to be great. But you know, his father used to be a member of the Mau Mau. You didn't know that part, did you? His father was a supporter of the Mau Mau. You know who the Mau Mau were in Kenya? The Mau Maus had a philosophy. I guess this will sum it up. One settler, one bullet. The Mau Mau was the liberation movement of Kenya against the British occupation, against the British colonialism. And most of the Mau Mau leaders, including Jomo Kenyatta, who would come to be president of Kenya, were thrown into jail by the British. So Obama's father was a pretty radical dude in Kenya. But then again I said, he was raised where he was raised. His past, his history is what it is. And dreams of my father inspired white folks to transcend their fear of black people. Because here was the penultimate American story. I mean, you read the book, tears all in your eyes, you know, you start saying, oh man, this is wonderful. He overcame all of these things. I mean, he went to Harvard Law School. He went to Chicago. He became an activist. He could have been a member of any corporation. He could have been a corporate lawyer. If he could have been a corporate lawyer, he would have never been president. We wouldn't be having this discussion. He went to Chicago to get trained by some of the baddest mittenmen in black politics. If you don't think that we've had some of the most heinous shysters in black politics to come out of Chicago, think again. Don't start me to name in names because I don't want to talk about Jesse and all of them. But Chicago has been a hotbed of black opportunism and black political misleadership. So he went there and got trained, and to his benefit, you know, he did what he did. My point is that this is a man of the moment. Jimmy Carter was a man of the moment. Ronald Reagan was a man of the historical moment. Richard M. Nixon was a man of the moment. So don't think that the situation we are in today is beyond you being the person of the moment. Because it's not. Some of you sitting over there who are in law school might one day be the Attorney General of the United States. Then what? You're going to be like Shawcross or whatever that knucklehead's name was? Then what? You're going to say, oh, I'm Attorney General. What are you going to say? What type of laws are you going to say? Well, I heard a lecture by Daruba Bin Wahab when I was in law school, and I ain't going to never, ever do anything but become a prosecutor. Because we got to keep Negroes like that in check. Because he's obviously crazy. White people very seldom confront white supremacy and racism and white skin privilege. Just as men very seldom confront male privilege. How many men you know in here will confront male privilege without women getting in their butt? Not too many. Because you know how homeboys get when they get together, man. I'm telling you, man, them women, man, they should be on. That's how they be. I'm telling you, I know. You know, last time I looked, I was a man, so I know. And so, you know, without that pressure, ain't nobody going to really fess up to anything, man. You know, because nobody wants to be embarrassed. Nobody wants to feel like they're oppressing other people. Nobody wants to feel like they're unjust. This is just human. Nobody wants to be, I mean, some people maybe, but most people want to try to at least appear fair. Right? So, no one's going to lay claim to this, but homeboy said that, you know, I'm presenting this message of irreconcilable differences. And he felt that we should be able to go inside of the institutions and change them from within. I said, well, good luck to that. Because I have not known one institution in America that was changed from within. Do you know one? Where have all the reforms that we are talking about came from? They came from without. They came from people like you taking to the streets and making sure that these principles were upheld. In Islam, it's said to the Muslims. And this is a prerequisite to the Muslims. In Islam, in the Quran, it said to the Muslims, O ye who believe, let there arise from amongst you a band of believers who will enjoin the right and forbid the wrong. Enjoin what's right and forbid the wrong. Who will arise from amongst these law students who will enjoin justice and forbid injustice? Maybe the person that should be giving this lecture is a very good friend of mine, Robert Boyle, who's an attorney at law in New York State. And he's the individual that got me out of prison. Him and Liz Fink, a Jewish woman with weight issues. And a mighty fighter in the courtroom. A mighty woman in the courtroom. These are people who fought for me for 10 years without a penny. Why? Because they believed in justice. And they fought for justice. Not for opportunity, not for career advancement, but for justice. And I hate to use cliches, but as long as America denies justice to people of color and to people who are oppressed, there will be no peace. America will have to wage war forever. You know, it's very hard for an imperial entity with 170-plus bases around the world to do that with a volunteer army. And the volunteer army came into existence when? At the end of the 60s. As a result of what? Protests in the streets. When the 1954 Supreme Court decision was passed in Brown versus the Board of Education, did white folks run into the streets talking about hallelujah? They resisted every step of the way the integration of schools. They devised every means and mechanism to avoid it. And then when they finally couldn't get around it, they had to agree to it. And then they start talking about funding for private schools. When the laws in the United States that weren't on the books, when there weren't any laws on the books to govern how migrant workers were being treated in the Southwest, it was Cesar Chavez and the movements of migrant workers who changed that. It was changed from without. When women in this country didn't have the right to vote, it was women who took to the streets, the suffrage movement. Look at the film that changed that. None of these changes came from within the institutions. None of these changes came from within. They all were forced from without. So this historical moment belongs to you. It belongs to all of those people who are part and parcel of the globalization movement, who understand what New Age imperialism really represents. It's up to them. It's up to the anarchists throwing bricks through the Gucci display window. It's up to them to be the rage in the machine, to be the cutting edge against this, to the point where now you have no freedom of speech. Do you know that? If they were to convene today in this city a convention to institutionalize war or to sanction war, another war, and you decided to come out and demonstrate against it, what would they do to you? They would tell you the demonstration, the free speech area is 1 mile from the venue. We'll have the cameras there. You can do your interviews there. We'll give you wireless networks access, and that's where you hold your demonstration, and the conference will be over here. And the people that you're demonstrating against won't hear nothing. Quite different than the Chicago riots during the Democratic Convention. Remember Chicago? They smelt the tear gas in the hotel. They had to go into their rooms with their handkerchiefs up because they smelt the tear gas. That's what the anarchists bring. They bring on the noise. Without noise, there's no music. What's the difference between noise and music? You ever thought about that? What's the difference between noise and music? Noise disturbs you. Music soothes and inspires you. That's the difference. So bring on the noise and disturb these bastards. They need to be disturbed. And those that are in the legal profession and want to pursue a career in legality, you should really research the auspices of these laws that we're talking about. Because you're not going to get it in law school. Have you heard about the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration from your law professor? Have you heard about it? Did he ever tell you about it? Did he ever tell you how the RICO Act came into existence? The Omnibus Crime and Safe Streets Act, how RICO evolved? It was evolved to do what? To fight the mafia and organized crime. That's what they tell you, right? But go look it up. Go ask your professor these questions. Say, I'm very interested in understanding the basis of RICO conspiracy theory. You know, a conspiracy theory that says if I know you and you know her and she commits a crime, I'm guilty. That's deep. I'm guilty, you guilty, and she's guilty. And actually, there's no degree in difference in the guilt. It's like the accomplice in an armed robbery, you know. So, in an armed robbery, you know, the accomplice is almost as, if a murder is committed in an armed robbery, you get a murder charge. Even if you didn't pull the trigger, you see? Of course, that doesn't apply to people like George Bush because he could murder millions of people and get away with it. But that's a whole different issue. My point is that you have to transform your career into something that's historically meaningful in the moment. And when I say historical moment, I don't mean the last 2 years or 5 years. It could last your lifetime. You know, Rome didn't collapse in a day. And America is sure not going to collapse in an hour. It's a process. It speeds up, it slows down, it moves here, it moves there. But it's a process. And it's very important for us to understand this process, how it's working on us, how it works, how do we begin to gather information in the age of information? It's relevant. We have so much information today, it's information overload. This is glutted information. And Huey B. Newton said that information is intelligence. That power is the ability to define phenomena and make it act in the desired fashion. Power is the ability to define reality and make that reality act in your behalf. That's what power is. That's why lawyers are always shot right after the revolution. Because their job is to define reality. That's the job. So the first thing you do is you shoot the lawyers that define the other reality, and you put your lawyers in to define the new reality. I know it sounds cynical. I don't mean to be cynical. I mean to be truthful. And that's the bottom line. Lawyers exist to define the social writ. To research and define the social writ. To practice those definitions of the social writ in civil and criminal proceedings. And it's very difficult for you in this day and age to be in a profession that has sanctioned waterboarding, that has sanctioned torture, that has sanctioned imperialism, that has sanctioned military adventures abroad, that has sanctioned murder of innocent civilians. It's very difficult to be in a profession that has done that. And at the same time, deal with a nation and a government that is critical of irregulars who do the same thing. You know, ever since the bombing of Dresden in, I believe, 1944, civilians were no longer innocent. Civilians were legitimate military targets because civilians made the war effort possible. They supported the troops morally, ethically, spiritually, and financially, and economically. They were the ones that populated the factories, that made the guns, that killed the enemy. So civilians became a legitimate target by the leaders and the allies in World War II. And from that point on, the idea and the notion of terrorism as something other than a tactic of war is absurd. How is there a war on a tactic? What is a war on terrorism? That's like declaring a war on amphibious invasions. Terrorism is a tactic that is used and has been used by both states and non-state entities almost since the beginning of time. So how do you declare a war on it? You declare a war on it when your country is in crisis, when your empire is in crisis, and you have to consolidate the type of power that would deprive them of their civil liberties. That's why today, democratic fascism, the national security state, sees all of you as potential terrorists. Not potential contributors to society. Not as individuals that can make life better for people, but as potential terrorists. We're taught, if you see anything suspicious, or you hear anyone saying anything, report it to the local officials. That's what they used to do in Nazi Germany, remember? Have you read about Nazi Germany? What did the Nazis do? They had children snitching on their parents, brothers snitching on their sisters, sisters snitching on their mothers. Anyone that was critical of Adolf Hitler and the Nazi party, if you said anything in public, or you said something around an unguarded moment, you would disappear. Now, last time I heard the word disappear used in America, it was in conjunction with rendition. They disappeared. And the United States today under Obama is still running rendition camps in Kenya, in East Africa, in Eastern Europe. They're still running these camps. Right here in the United States, you have a Guantanamo in Colorado. You have almost all of the political prisoners that are in federal custody in Colorado. Imam Jamil Al-Amin, formerly H.Rap Brown. 23-hour lockdown in Colorado. One visit a month. One phone call a month. That sounds like Guantanamo to me. Same thing. How much time of recreation do they get out there selling Guantanamo? 1 hour. How many phone calls are they allowed to make? Zip. How many legal visits are they permitted a month? Zip. Who are they? Who are these people in Guantanamo who have fallen between the ideals of the Magna Carta in the U.S. Constitution? Who are they? These people who have somehow are outside of the purview of the Geneva Convention and the Convention on Human Rights. Who are they? Who are these people that don't deserve any justice? Who are they? What crimes have they committed to make them, to put them in this situation? What crimes have they committed? They are defined as what? Illegal combatants. Isn't that the term that's used? Illegal enemy combatants, right? Well, what category? Have anybody seen that category in the Geneva Convention? It's something that an attorney made whole cloth to justify what George Bush did. Now, what are the principles of Nuremberg? That those who facilitate genocide, that those who write about genocide to justify it, that those who contribute to the rulers carrying out genocidal policies are equally as guilty as those who carried out the genocide. That's the basis, that was the principles in the Nuremberg trial. You couldn't get away being the minister of propaganda and said you didn't have nothing to do with the extermination of gypsies and Roma people and Jews and people who, and communists. You couldn't say that. I ain't had nothing to do with it. I just wrote the parameters of discipline. I just wrote the legal parameters for Auschwitz concentration camp. I wasn't running the camp. I had nothing to do with Dachau. That didn't work in Nuremberg. Was that an argument that was accepted in Nuremberg? No. Why do we accept that argument today? Why is it applicable to people like you who work under the Bush administration, who justified and rationalized torture? How is it possible for the Obama administration to come into power and say that we're not going to pursue the violators of these laws when they have in their prisons political prisoners who've been in jail for 30 years? 30 years. Many of you aren't even 30 years old in here. These brothers and sisters went to prison before you were born. But there is no reconciliation around that. Whenever the powers that be are forced to change or are thrown out of power, they talk about reconciliation and they talk about reapproachment. When the racists in South Africa had to concede power to the black majority, did Nelson Mandela and the ANC go after the people that murdered Stephen Biko? That murdered and tortured thousands and thousands of black Africans? Did any of these cops stand before a court of law and were judged on their actions? No. The Truth and Reconciliation Committee was established. You know, and then the guy that murdered Stephen Biko could come out and say, you know, I feel bad about this. I really, you know, I just want you to know that, and the family sitting right there, the murdered man, sorry, you know, okay, see you later, you're sorry, let's move on. But when a black man stands up for the black community and defends the black community and is framed and put in jail like Mumia Abu-Jamal, he can't make parole. It's the nature of the crime that's so heinous that he can't get out of jail. But here these dogs murdered and enslaved an entire nation of people, and not one of them went to jail. Not one. Not one. Why? Because truth and reconciliation only occurs when those in power are overthrown. And there's no retribution, because retribution means redistribution of wealth, and it means foremost the establishment of justice. Which brings me to my final point, Palestine. Justice. Justice. As long as there is a contradiction in history that does not provide justice for an oppressed people, it will never be resolved. Never. Every conflict that we see today in the world has its root in a history of injustice. that was never addressed. Whether it's the Congo, whether it's Somalia, whether it's Kenya, whether it's the Yemen, whether it's Saudi Arabia, whether it's Darfur, these are all historical contradictions that were created by imperialist powers that were never addressed according to the principles of justice. That's why the people continue to fight. That's why the contradiction continues to exist. And in terms of Palestine, we see that the United States has carried out a policy to support a European settler state in an area and a region of a world that is geopolitically important to Western civilization. The idea and the notion of the Middle East is a complete fabrication and idea of the imperialist powers. Before World War I, the term Middle East was never used. The term Middle East, Far East, and Near East is a geopolitical construct of the imperialists. Almost every nation that you have in that region, almost every nation, Kuwait, Abu Dhabi, United Arab Emirates, Jordan, Lebanon, all of these states were created by who? The Europeans. The Europeans created every one of those states, and they created every one of those states in a struggle, in a conflict, in a historical moment. And that historical moment was the end of World War I and the destruction of the Ottoman Empire. They used divide and conquer. Both Turks and Arabs were Muslims, but the Turks were the administrators. So they used divide and conquer. At the same time that the imperial powers were using divide and conquer, mainly Britain and France, to overthrow the Ottoman Empire and open up the territory of what they call the Middle East to European penetration and dominance, from that point on, it was necessary to establish a military presence in that region, a supreme military presence. And that military presence is the Zionist State of Israel. That's why it's there. And this has been a dream of the Europeans ever since Columbus sailed west to go east. Ever since Mehmet took Constantinople and turned it into Istanbul. This has been an objective of the West ever since, to establish a permanent military presence and control in a vital region of this planet, the so-called Middle East. And that's the purpose and the existence that Israel serves. That's the existence, that's their purpose. Now, what does that have to do with us here? It has everything to do with us here, because the United States subsidizes that entity to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars a month. But they have no money for inner city urban schools. They have no money to put our children, give our children a decent education, to provide daycare for single mothers. They have no money for none of these things that benefit the American people, but they got money to bolster a racist state that has engaged in apartheid since its very existence. This money exists. And who allocates this money? The Ways and Means Committees, the Committees on Foreign Relations, and who sits on these committees? Black elected officials. Black congressmen, black senators. When there's an important bill that deals with Israel, it's aye. When there's an important bill that deals with Israel that has no effect, it's nay. Like the Goldstone Report. Look at the voting record of the Black Caucus on other issues that reflected on the Middle East and the war in the Middle East and the Afghan war. And you see that the majority of black elected officials voted yes in perpetuating those policies. But when it came to the Goldstone Report, which had no effect whatsoever on anything, they all voted no. So they'll tell me, don't tell me that I'm a pro-Zionist lobbyist because I'm infected by this, because I voted no on the Goldstone Report. But your vote didn't mean nothing. When it came to something that meant something, you either voted yes or you were absent. So what are you saying? We have black elected officials in our community that are more concerned with the existence of the state of Israel than they are with the black community that they represent. And how is that possible? Because of money. Because of money. The lobbyists provide funds and they provide moral sanctity to these politicians because they're not challenged by us. White people can't challenge these politicians. You can't even challenge your own. I mean, 80% of the people in the United States were opposed to the war in Iraq under the Bush administration, and the war continued. The war is still continuing to this day. The United States has been in Iraq longer than it was in World War II. And the guy that got elected to office to talk about he will go talk to anybody anywhere and do anything in order to bring about peace, who got a Nobel Peace Prize, this man got a Nobel Peace Prize just for being who he was. Because his whole speech, his acceptance speech, was what? About just war. Have you ever heard a Nobel Peace Prize laureate talk about how war was just? Come on. Compare that to Martin Luther King. But then also realize that what was being done was legitimizing a historical moment. That's what the Nobel Peace Prize represented. The legitimization of a historical moment. Because who else won the Nobel Peace Prize? Menachem Begin? Menachem Begin. They couldn't give the Nobel Peace Prize to Sadat himself. So they included Menachem Begin because they said Sadat put out his hand and Menachem Begin shook it. So they both get the Peace Prize. Because Egypt was the first state to recognize Israel. And Menachem Begin took a bold move to do this. So he deserved the Nobel Peace Prize. They said the same thing about the clerk. If the clerk brought about the reconciliation of the white population in South Africa, so now you have a multiracial state. And for that, you understand, him and Mandela gets the Peace Prize. So now Obama gets elected to office, talks smack about peace and world peace and justice, and he gets the Peace Prize and gives a speech about war. And everybody said, well, it's all cool, it's all good. You know, this was like a Nobel Peace Prize in advance of doing something. This was like a Nobel Peace Prize on credit. This was like a debit card Peace Prize. You know, if you ain't got no money in the bank, you can't get it. You know, they'll really embarrass your ass in the store. You understand? Sorry, sir, it's not authorized. So he's pre-Peace Prize. And then he turns right around and sends 50,000 troops to where? Afghanistan. Good Peace Prize. You know? That's like giving a Peace Prize to Attila the Hun. You know, you brought peace because you murdered everybody. And it's all quiet now. You see? And then he comes up with a policy talking about, well, you know, besides just wars, we have to understand, you know, we can win this war. And I'm sending 50,000 troops to win this war because we know that we're having a new policy of engagement. In summation, I want to say that the historical moment that you're living in now, the legal system that we're struggling under now, the fight for our human and civil rights in this country are issues that we all need to engage ourselves in from wherever we're at, from academia, as students, as just ordinary people. We need to organize ourselves where we are at, in our community, around those issues that immediately affect our lives. This world has become a global community. But at the same time, it's become a global community because of technology. Increasingly, people are relying on close-knit networks in order to survive. So at the same time we're dealing with globalization, we're dealing with a contraction of our idea of community. Are we indeed our brother and sister's keeper? And if we are our brothers and sister's keeper, who are our brothers and sisters that we keep? Just those that we know or those from afar? What happens in the courtrooms in America directly affect the United States' position legally in the world. What happens domestically in America with immigrant populations, with poor people, with women, with the marginalized, the criminalization of whole entire communities, the creation of an industry of prisons, all have reflected themselves in U.S. foreign policy. So before the United States commits injustices abroad, it first must commit those injustices against you. And you have to accept it as part of being American, as part of this American exceptionality. That, you know, America is the blessing of the planet. It's the light of the world. It's the light of humanity. And we all should be proud to be American, because we are all part of that light. You are part of the light only when you step on the stage. Other than that, you're in the shadows. So I'm going to encourage all of you to please participate in the programs to support political rights of political detainees and the rights of political prisoners. Stand up for what is right. You're not alone, and you won't be defeated. You'll only be defeated if you don't believe in your mission and if you don't believe in what you're doing. When I was in prison for 19 years, I was told that I would never get out of prison. Other prisoners used to say, damn, man, you think they're really going to let you out? And every year that I was in prison, I was getting out that year. Every year. The lawyer says, damn, ever since I met you, you were getting out of prison this year. Every year. Because I would not let them define my reality for me. And you cannot let these people that are leading this nation to hell define your reality for you. And that's my message. Stand up for what is right. Let there arise from amongst you a band of people who will enjoy the right and forbid the wrong. Thank you.
Tansa toya kakioni wakuma kantik. Winston Wataninia, Miksuachi, Saskatchewan, Neotsian.
I am Winston Watini. I am from Saskatchewan. Knowledge is power. We must gather knowledge to protect our children, our culture, our future. Learn the ways you can protect yourself and others from infection and spreading HIV. Teach others what you have learned. Together, we can make a difference.
Cadell, broadcasting from North Jefferson County, Kansas, smack dab between Kansas City, Topeka, Lawrence, Atchison. Easiest way to describe it. Put together quite a good show. Think you're going to like it.
Radio Free Kansas on blogtalkradio.com/fightingcockfire.
Nicely played. Sachin is off the mark.
घरेलू हिंसा में बाधा डालकर उसे रोको। बेल बजाओ। घरेलू हिंसा अधिनियम पर जानकारी के लिए bellbajao.org पर लॉग ऑन करें। ब्रेक थ्रू की पहल।
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
It's our news desk.
Conservative candidate Bolsonaro won the Brazilian presidential election with 55% of the vote. This is a surprising shift for a country previously run by the Workers' Party from 2003 to 2016. And with its use of hateful rhetoric around marginalized groups and the violence this has already led to on the streets, alarm bells have been ringing in the human rights world. I'm Niusha Bastani.
And I'm Max Curtis. From the University of Cambridge and the Center of Governance and Human Rights, this is Declarations. So, everyone's asking, how did Bolsonaro win? What does this mean for Brazil's future? But his victory also raises more systemic questions, not just about the rise of far-right parties globally, but also about the legacy of Brazil's not-so-dated dictatorship and the lack of intergenerational memory about authoritarian human rights violations, which Bolsonaro seems to condone and maybe even praise. Some of the most significant resistance was led by women. So in this episode, we're taking a hard look at the role of memory and gender in the rise of Brazil's far-right, and in particular, what this means for the country's most marginalized groups.
So our guest today, who we're lucky to have to help us make sense of all this, is Dr. Malu Gatto. Her work explores the gender dynamics of political behavior, representation, and policymaking with a focus on Latin America, especially Brazil. She's a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Zurich with a PhD from Oxford. And this coming year, she'll be an assistant professor of Latin American politics at UCL, University College London's Institute of the Americas. Thanks for joining us, Malu.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm really